Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
We're not scientific at all. Pass by trees, flowers, fields of corn. We don't even see it. The white supremacists go to the bottom of the ocean and study one grain of sand, bring it and put it under a microscope. The black person passes by and say, "What are you doing there, Ralph?" "See, I'm studying this grain of sand that I got 8,000 feet from the bottom of the ocean." "And what are you studying a grain of sand for?" "I'm studying it because it's there. And I'm going to find out why it's there. And I'm going to find out everything about it. How it got there, what it does while it was there, what it can be used for by me." To dominate you.
Scientists have been experimenting with a wild idea, looking to nature for inspiration in the design of new machines and robots. The goal? To improve devices and innovations to transform medicine and much more. Miles O'Brien reports for our Breakthrough series on the leading edge of science and technology.
In the never-ending hunt for new designs that jump, pump, or run faster and better, scientists are finding inspiration when they look out the windows of their labs or in the mirror.
Almost everything that we are trying to do in engineering is actually really in some ways trying to replicate the beauty and the intricacy and the complexity of what we find in nature.
Bioengineer Rashid Bashir and his team at the University of Illinois are developing so-called biobots that move using real muscles activated by flashes of light. Bashir sees lots of potential applications, like toxic cleanup or tiny clot-busting bots to treat people with heart disease.
What we're doing is trying to recapitulate what exists in nature. So now the idea is that, well, can we start to learn some of those design rules? How can we build non-natural systems with these living cells?
Bashir's work is part of an accelerating trend. Welcome to the odd and yet familiar world of bio-inspired design, or biomimicry.
Biomimicry is innovation inspired by nature.
Janine Benyus is a biologist and writer who popularized the term, writing a book on the subject in 1997.
Take methane and turn it into plastics.
She remains in the vanguard of the field.
You have novelty and sustainability. That's why a lot of inventors are now turning towards biomimicry.
Physicist Seth Fraden is among them. He directs the Bio-Inspired Soft Materials Center at Brandeis University. Here they want to understand the fundamentals of how living things move.
We're talking about blurring the boundaries between the animate and the inanimate.
He and his collaborator Zvanimir Dojic are working on artificial cilia, tiny hair-like projections on the surface of cells. They work together in sync to move fluids. While these cilia are microscopic, They could lead to the development of more sophisticated materials to carry out more complicated tasks, like pipes that need no pumps.
Your heart will pump fluids. Your intestine will pump fluids. Now, if we want to pump oil through a pipe, we have to have a pump at one end and create pressure to drive it. Why can't we have tubing that consumes energy from the fluid that flows through it, much as our heart consumes the energy from the blood that flows through it and then contract?
Is it alive?
No, it's not alive. It's just a simple machine, but instead of having an external pump that's composed of many dead components, a fluid is composed of millions and millions of individual components, and under certain conditions, all of these machines go in a certain direction and push fluid with it.
Kostya Korneff and his team at Clemson University are also looking at nature's means of moving fluids. They are focused on the mouth or proboscis of butterflies to inspire a breakthrough in materials science. Korneff and his team want to make synthetic fibers with similar properties. Eventually, they want to build a micro-siphon that would suck up or dispense tiny drops of fluid. Such a device would have wide-ranging applications, like new medical tools.
So you can think about poking the single cell, taking a little droplet from particular, the nucleus or somewhere in the spot of the single cell, or if you can go to the brain and do the surgery on the brain.
Roboticist Sarah Bergbreiter is thinking along the same lines. She and her team build tiny robots inspired by insects, which can be impressive jumpers. Fleas can leap 200 times their body length.
What we can do is compress this and store energy in those rubber bands and release those for a jump.
Bergbreiter sees a day when microbots could carry cameras and sensors into small places for surveillance, perform microsurgery, crawl into cracks to monitor the structural safety of buildings and bridges, even deploy on search and rescue missions.
My picture is always you have a bucket full of these small robots. You dump them into rubble after disaster, and they have just enough energy to find somebody and say, hey, dig over here.
She builds her robots using 3D printers. This burgeoning manufacturing technique enables engineers and inventors to think out of the design box that has existed since the advent of the Industrial Revolution. Near Boston, at 3D printing startup Desktop Metal, they're using artificial intelligence to do the designing. Engineer Andy Roberts tells the machine what stresses a part will encounter, and the software does the rest.
This is a nature-inspired tool that is intended to make it easy to create these crazy-shaped parts here. In this one, we're growing three different stems towards a common target. And while they look like three organisms right now, they will join together and fuse into a single one. This ability to simulate these random and cumulative forces that you see in nature all the time tends to give these parts a more resilient overall behavior.
Check out this AI-designed skateboard.
I've triggered the growth of this design from a single seed cell on the base plate down here.
So when the machine is told to design a machine, it makes something that looks like it belongs in nature. Oh, the irony.
Ultimately, the truly biomimetic idea is that you're functionally indistinguishable from the wildland next door.
But it does stand to reason. After all, nature has been perfecting designs for 3.8 billion years. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Boston.
It's the sport of kings, better than diamond rings.
Football.
On this Super Bowl weekend, with all the hype and hoopla, it can be hard to imagine that football is actually losing popularity. But after a decade of publicity about brain injuries, many boys and their parents are choosing less risky sports like soccer or basketball. A national association that tracks high school sports found that participation in football programs has dropped by 6% over the last decade. There is an exception to this trend. low-income students. HBO reported this week that in one state, Illinois, participation in football by low-income high school students has actually risen 25% over the last 5 years. Albert Samaha has given a lot of thought to the reasons behind this. He's the author of the book Never Ran, Never Will, Boyhood and Football in a Changing American Inner City. And he's with us now. Albert Samaha, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand that you played football yourself in college. How did you get started in the sport? And did you think about the risks when you were playing?
I did not think about the risks. You know, I got started in the sport, I think, in the most traditional possible way, which is that a lot of my older relatives, my cousins, my uncles watched the sport, played the sport. And I played football, basketball, baseball, like a lot of other kids. And I just happened to be best at football. And it really wasn't until lately that I've even thought about the long-term damage that could happen to me and whether I would ever want, if I had, you know, a son, to let that kid play football. I hadn't really thought of that before.
So you spent 2 seasons reporting on the Mo Better Jaguars, which is a Pop Warner team in Brownsville, Brooklyn. And I will confess that I'm familiar with this community because I grew up there. But tell me about the kids who were playing with this team and why. And one of the things that really intrigued me about your reporting is that you said that this is the first generation of players to really know the risks or to think about the risks. So just talk a little bit about the community and why kids play there.
Yeah, so, you know, Brownsville is kind of notorious for having the highest concentration of housing projects of any zip code in America. It's one of the, you know, more low-income communities in New York City and across America. And as you mentioned, for 2-3 years, I kind of embedded with these 10, 11, 12-year-old kids. And I think one of the things I found most interesting is that when I think a lot of people on the outside think about why kids play football, their assumption is, oh, well, you know, they're just putting all their hopes and dreams into these NFL aspirations. But I found that wasn't the case at all. That, in fact, you know, these kids were playing not just because they wanted college scholarships, but because they wanted financial aid to some of the top private high schools in the city. And I think, you know, the reasons that football is so valuable to them is the fact that it's still the sport that's the most popular in America, that is getting the most money from high schools and colleges in America. And at a time when, you know, the educational gap continues to widen between, you know, low-income, particularly black and brown kids, and higher-income white kids, football offers a path to upward mobility that is not really available through any other extracurricular activities.
Why football? Why not other sports?
It's a numbers game. Football offers far more college scholarships than any sport. Even though football only covers boys and not girls, you know, there's more football scholarships available for boys than there are basketball and soccer and baseball scholarships available for boys and girls. Not to mention the fact that, obviously, basketball requires certain physical attributes, you know, a certain amount of height. Football, unlike other sports, doesn't require you to be a certain size or a certain height. You can sort of play it whether you're, you know, overweight, whether you're underweight. There are different positions you can play. It's sort of the most, in some ways, meritocratic of all the sports available for these opportunities. You know, kids aren't going to get the same opportunities if they're really, really good at playing the trumpet or really, really good at chess, because this is where our society has decided to put its priorities.
So you talked about how the kids are very savvy. What about the parents? I mean, well, we'll talk about the kids and the parents. I mean, they've presumably heard about the risks of brain trauma that has been part of the conversation for the last, you know, decade. Are they aware of this?
They are aware of it. And I think to a lot of these kids and their parents, it's the luxury to worry about these long-term sort of abstract damages, right? Like, to these kids and their parents, the dangers are all around them. The risks are all around them. The risks of not going to a good high school, the risks of not making it into college. So they have to kind of prioritize their needs. And they have these immediate needs to get into good schools and to have opportunities to reach upward mobility, that kind of those distant concerns of what may happen to their brain 20, 30 years down the line. It's a calculus that both the kids and parents have weighed and have decided that these long-term risks are worth putting up with these short-term advancements.
There was an article drawn from your book that you wrote for the New York Times back in September, and you talked about the ethical reckoning that this country has to face around football. What is that ethical reckoning in your view?
I think at the core of this is that the dangers of the sport will increasingly fall on the shoulders of low-income black and brown kids. The money from the sport is going to white coaches and white owners, white university presidents, and the dangers are falling on kind of the least privileged among us. So it's increasingly becoming this kind of gladiatorial dichotomy that we're seeing. And, you know, one question I think a lot of people wonder, at least I wonder a lot, is whether the future of football, I think there's kind of three paths. Either it goes in this continuous path that it continues to be the most popular sport in America. It'll just be a higher proportion of poor kids and black and brown kids that are taking the burden of those risks. Or it'll become like baseball, where it'll just kind of slowly decline in popularity, maybe behind soccer and basketball. Or it'll become like boxing, where it loses both popularity and participation rates, and it's increasingly just kind of becoming a sport for the desperate.
That was Albert Samaha. He's the author of Never Ran, Never Will, Boyhood and Football in a Changing American Inner City. He was with us from the NPR Bureau in New York. Albert Samaha, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rocking, the chip off the block.
We want to take a moment now to recognize Michelle King, former superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District. She died Saturday at age 57 after a battle with cancer. When she was appointed superintendent in 2016, we sent KPCC's Prisca Neely to talk to teachers at Hamilton High School in Mid-City, L.A., where King spent years as a principal. Here's how her colleagues talked about her back then.
Everybody has a sense that she cares about them.
It was always like no problem was too small.
Boy, does she listen.
That's members of the Hamilton High staff, Fran Rose, Marlene Zuccaro, Rosemary Bernier. Librarian Rosemary Bernier recalled the day when she told King, who was her supervisor at the time, about a big accomplishment.
When I got National Board certification, I choked up. I went in to tell her and show her my certificate. You know what she did? She grabbed my hands and we jumped up and down together because she was thrilled for me and she was thrilled for the kids.
When King took over as principal at Hamilton in 2002, the school was going through a time of upheaval. Fran Rose said King helped to get things back on track.
After the upheaval, she was the calming influence, and I think really turned things around at this school, and I'm hoping she does the same thing with the district.
But her time as leader was cut short. She took a medical leave after only 21 months on the job. To talk about what she was able to accomplish, we turn now to Kyle Stokes, education reporter for KPCC. Kyle, welcome.
Good to be here.
Michelle King was the first African-American woman to run LAUSD after a 30-plus year career rising through the ranks. She was clearly well-regarded by her colleagues. Kyle, what was the most what was she most recognized for when it came to her work?
Well, I think the biggest thing that she'll be remembered for is her championing of a push to raise the school district's graduation rate, the so-called 100% graduation push. This wasn't a goal that she came up with. She inherited it. But under her leadership, the school district really embraced that goal. The school district's rates initially looked like they even topped 80% according to the way that they were calculated at the time. Since then, the state has come back after a federal audit and knocked it down a couple of percentage points to about 76% is where the graduation rates got to during her tenure. But regardless, the district sort of put together an all-hands-on-deck effort to try and make sure that students got the remedial coursework that they needed. There were some questions about whether or not the coursework was legitimate, too many students taking credit recovery courses, questions about this. But it certainly took an effort to coordinate all of that work. And Michelle King, it was under her leadership that all of this took place.
Tell us about her style, her approach to running LAUSD. I mean, second biggest district in the nation.
Yeah, I think the style was reflected in one of the pieces of tape that we just heard from someone at Hamilton High School talking about calming the waters at Hamilton High School. Well, I think that was the reason that she was picked back in 2016, to calm the waters. She was a calming presence to a lot of people. She was a deal maker. She was, sort of a peacemaker, a consensus builder. That was something that she, sort of burnished her reputation for as she moved up the ranks in the LA Unified School District, and really, I think, solidified that as her presence. She was not a flashy figure. She was not someone who is out in public. And I think that is one of the interesting what makes Michelle King a very interesting case study. She was someone who could inspire the love that you hear in that tape from those people at Hamilton High School, whom she was their boss. But, you know, at the same time, the lack of flash, you know, it both helped her and it hurt her as she sort of attempted to get things done in the 20 months or so that she had to get them done.
Well, let's talk about what she was able to get done in the short amount of time she had.
Yeah. So one of the things that got started under her watch was the so-called unified enrollment system. Michelle King wanted to make the school district a lot more of a district of choice and expand school choice options for parents. Unified enrollment was one of the things that got started under her watch, though I don't know how much of a plan, a direct champion of the unified enrollment plan she was. The idea that parents could have basically a one-stop shop where they could file all of their applications to get into the district's various prestigious programs of choice. A couple times put those deal-making skills on display. For instance, she forged a partnership with an organization that had come to be basically, and critics would say that it came to be out of a potential threat to LAUSD. This was the organization Great Public Schools Now that was formed out of a plan by the charter school-backed Broad organization. They put out a draft plan that talked about expanding the number of charters. They since rebranded. Well, today, Great Public Schools Now is working with the district to help replicate some of the district's most successful schools. And King also oversaw some reductions in central office budgets. But at the same time, she also, despite the fact that she was a deal maker and continues to have that reputation, she failed to really win political support when the chips were thrown down. For instance, when she came to the school board with a strategic plan back in 2016 and 2017, she was really spent much of her first year trying to put together this broader vision for what the school district was going to be going forward. And the school board was tepid at best about that plan and never actually signed off on it. So we got only a little hint of what Michelle King, the deal maker, was capable of. And one of the things was whether or not that strategic plan was going to move forward. You know, she at the time that she sort of dropped it, hadn't really sold school board members on it.
Now, of course, we'll never know what she could have accomplished. But what does it mean for the current superintendent, Austin Buettner, and anyone who comes after him? I mean, Michelle King was extremely well-liked, yet she still struggled to make real change happen at the district.
Yeah, I think that this is one of those interesting questions about leadership in a district like LA Unified. A lot of time, you have, you know, superintendents like Austin Buettner, like King's the last person to hold the job on a permanent basis prior to King, John Daisy. Both are very comfortable in public, making broad statements, trying to drum up public support through the press, through political actions. And Michelle King was the opposite of that. She was shy around cameras, was not very comfortable speaking to reporters. And I think that sort of speaks to the sort of contrast here. Buettner has a lot of things that he would like to get done, and he's able to go out and drum up support for it in the press. King was hoping to build that behind closed doors. And I think given you might need a little bit more time than the average urban superintendent is going to get if that's going to work, if you're going to be able to leave a deeper mark on the school district. I think that's the sort of tension around how to view Michelle King and her tenure. Can you be an urban superintendent in a district as big and as complex with LA Unified without being friendly with the press and willing to go out and kind of barnstorm for the priorities that you have?
KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
The man nut. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Last year, a mother in Durham decided to see for herself what in-school suspension looked like at her son's high school. Spent the day with him in an isolated high school room. Isolated room in the basement. She said she spotted bored kids without enough work to get them through the day. And she was most struck by something else. Nearly all the students in the room were boys of color, just like her son. She documented what she witnessed in a Facebook post that has since gone viral. That mother is our guest today. Reverend Fatima Saleh is a pastoral consultant in the Triangle area, the mother of four kids. Fatima, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Tell us how this whole thing got started. Your son got sent to ISS, right?
Sure. He got sent to ISS for horse playing, the words of the administrator who sent him. She said there was no one hurt. They were laughing, but they were horse playing in the cafeteria. And he got a day of ISS. From then on, he started laughing in ISS, and so then they gave him two more days of ISS for that. When he came home, he complained about ISS. He just said, all we do is face a wall. There's nothing to do. We can't. There's just nothing. We just face a wall. So I said, I doubt that that's what's happening. You need to pay for what you've done. This is accountability. And so I said, as much to prove him wrong, I said, I will sit with you in ISS, and one, to make sure you don't get more ISS, and two, to sort of dispel the idea that it couldn't possibly be like this.
Durham School of the Arts we're talking about.
Correct.
That was the school. And, of course, having your mother there with you, that'll keep you from laughing.
Yes, it did.
School,
it
right?
did.
So you go there, and you're telling him, look, it can't be that bad. What did you find?
I found it was worse than he described. I walked into the classroom with the other students. He had picked his desk facing the wall, an electrical socket. His desk was butted up to the wall, and I was right behind him. I then noticed that throughout the day, some students were not giving any classwork at all, and the others ranged between having two to four of their courses, and their teachers responding with material. And DSA, Durham School of the Arts, is particular in that it has seven courses throughout the day. And four to five of them may be your major courses. So I was deeply struck by the fact that there was a number of students who just didn't have any work at all, and the rest were maybe operating out of maybe 40% of their classwork,
What do you do in ISS?
That's a good question. When you have no work, what you did is you tried not to fall asleep. Because if you fell asleep and your head hit the desk or you put your head on the desk, you got another day of ISS. You had to be completely still and quiet. If you made any sounds and noises, then it would be punishable by another day of ISS.
So you talked about this in the Facebook post. You brought stuff to do. You brought stuff to do with you. And you by about 11 o'clock, you'd about run out. Huh?
I brought my Kindle and I started reading because I'm like, certainly I love to read it. I'm a voracious reader. So I sat there and about 10:58 is when I recorded on the first day. I just also want to clarify that I spent two full days in ISS. So it was 14 hours together. Both days running almost alike. But that around 10:58, I kind of broke. I was like, this is ridiculous. I cannot even sit here. The environment and feeling, the energy of the room was just deeply harrowing. And the fact that I was looking at, out of the 13 students in there, 11 of them were brown, black boys like my son. So it was so disproportionate in who was getting punished. And then I started to hear some of their stories of why they were there. And that was also deeply troubling.
And we should note that the Durham School of the Arts is, in fact, a diverse school, but only 35% of the population is white. But you saw a different ratio in terms of what you saw in ISS.
Correct. It was anywhere between 80 to 90%. The first day was 11 out of 13. And the second day that I was there was 11 students and nine of them were black boys.
Now, you didn't write this Facebook post right away. You talked to people at the school first, right?
Well, I talked to a teacher and I had talked to other parents and other students, but I did not bring it up with the administrator. I just sat there and I think I sat on it for a long time until my second son got ISS at DSA. And I said, well, it's now the Restorative Practice Center. He's like, all they changed was the paint. It's exactly the same.
We're talking about this change from it's now the Restorative Practice Center. It's something changed?
Yes.
They decided to revamp the way they were doing it?
Yes, sir.
Oh, so what did they tell you? So did you think there was change in the works? Is that
correct? And that's why I never wrote the piece. It was at the end of last school year, and I heard that there were initiatives on board to change it from ISS to Restorative Practice Center. And then when my second son got ISS – and said it was exactly the same.
And that's when you made the post.
Correct.
Well, I'm talking now to Reverend Fatima Saleh, who is a pastoral consultant in the Triangle and wrote that post on Facebook about her experience shadowing her son and in-school suspension. Last July, Durham Public School System announced a five-year, $5.5 million plan to improve safety in academics, and part of that plan was to replace in-school suspension with a restorative practice. They were going to be called restorative practice centers. Laverne Maddox-Perry is the senior Senior Executive Director of Student Support Services at Durham Public Schools, and she's the lead administrator heading up the project to get rid of in-school suspension. Welcome to the program, Laverne.
Thank you so much.
Talk to us more about this changeover and what's happening in Durham Public Schools.
Well, sure. So we have, as educators and as schools, been operating with ISS for a long time. Last spring and into the summer, Durham Public Schools made a decision with the support of the new superintendent and the school board that we no longer were going to engage in school suspension. We were going to invest our time in restorative practice centers with coordinators that were a part of a years-long tiered implementation plan for restorative practices across our schools. And so we began training in August 2018. And we started with restorative practice coordinators to really get moving in the direction away from punitive measures, such as the ones that the good pastor describes, into more restorative measures.
And what does that mean? What does that look like, restorative practices?
So restorative practices are basically those practices that are grounded in restorative justices. Restorative justice and that approach to moving from punitive and doing things to students and to moving to a with and restorative perspective where you hope you get to a point where students are able to continue their learning, feel respected, have mutual accountability for getting work completed in those restorative practice centers, and largely focus on the reflection piece of accountability for one's actions. Should there have been some violation of the student code of conduct? How do you work with students to make sure they're accountable and receive a consequence? However, it's done in the most respectful and restorative manner, because what we know is that that's how behaviors
right.
change.
Well, it sounds like that even after this got underway, Durham School of the Arts is still sending kids to the basement, looking at a wall and not engaged in this kind of restorative practice that brings all the parties together to work through what it was that happened. So why is that?
The transition is in progress, and I can tell you the account that the good pastor shared and that her son shared with her is no longer what Durham School of the Arts or any of our restorative practice centers look like. What her sharing her experience with us has done has really helped us to focus in on what things can we do immediately to show that not just the name change is occurring as we're getting the training, and it is a huge systemic shift, and it's going to cause a mindset shift. So it won't be done overnight. It is going to take us a long time. But what things can we put into action that demonstrate what is in our heart and our commitment to do? What can parents and students trust we're going to do differently? So we've started some of that stuff at Durham School of the Arts and other schools.
Fatima, it does sound like you're talking about a huge cultural shift here. Would you acknowledge it? It's going to take some time to do that. Are you satisfied that this is a process that's underway and may take some time to see the full fruit?
I'm weary of time. Time is what you do with it, according to Martin Luther King. And wait and is not a word that I'm comfortable with, especially when there are casualties happening right now. While the Restorative Practice Center, it still does not seem to address the disproportionate nature of black, brown boys. So even if it's a Restorative Practice Center, if it's still housed and populated by the same disproportionate number of black, brown boys leading us to a school-to-prison pipeline, I am deeply concerned that even if you change the makeup, that are we addressing that? And also, can students depend to get their classwork to them in the Restorative Practice Center? And what accountability is happening so that they're not in school and not being schooled?
What about that? Let's talk about this disproportionate and disparity.
Absolutely.
in the kind of students that we see sent to disciplinary pursuit, whatever you're going to call them.
Right. So we acknowledge, that is an issue we've been working on for quite a few years, and with a new learning and new ideas about ways to address that, it continues to be in our focus, and we recognize that we have to address the disproportionality as much as we address. What we're finding is that we're trending down in terms of all discipline, including those exclusions from school and those exclusions just from class for portion of the day, which is good news. However, we do know that we are working on the disproportionality, and we hope our restorative, and that's why we're investing so heavily in restorative practices and that restorative justice. And I was having a conversation with someone today, and it just occurred to me that the reason this is going to be powerful work to help us address exactly what the pastor is talking about is that it gives us an opportunity to give all students a chance to stop. It gives the adults a chance to stop and really try to restore relationship and to use reflection, questioning, and listening to one another to get to the point where you're no longer able, you no longer have to be removed from your classroom. And it allows for eliminating some of I'll just have to say it, implicit bias that may or may not exist in a particular school. It causes us all to pause and listen to one another and treat each student and each situation as an individual.
You talked about implicit bias. There are schools that have actually addressed that directly and found that where they had never believed and were shocked to find that implicit bias was there, things changed. And there's a way in which perhaps restorative practice, because of the reflection you talked about, may lead one to discover the implicit bias that's inherent in some of these disparities. So perhaps restorative practices could lead to some of the remedy. But what else are you doing to address directly? You said you've been thinking about it.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you address those
questions? So we see it as kind of like a three-pronged approach that we have to take as a district. Restorative practices and restorative justice, of course, is a part of it. But we also have to look at equity leadership and racial equity and addressing implicit bias. We've already started some of that training. We've started with leadership and with schools. And that's a tough conversation to have, but it's a conversation we have to have for it to be impactful. So in addition to that, we also are talking about culturally responsive pedagogy and what happens in the classroom. Students get put into an RPC or, you know, because there more than likely has been some interaction with another adult that draws attention. And so how do you utilize really culturally responsive pedagogy and tools so that the student doesn't have to leave the class at all? So all these, the three of them are the things that we're going to use to address some of this disproportionality.
We talked about a $5.5 million plan. What's the top priority in that plan overall? Because it's not, the whole plan is not about in-school suspension,
right?
I mean,
right.
it's a much larger plan than that. Sounds like it's a big plan, a strategic plan.
Right.
What are the goals? What are the primary goals in that
plan? For the strategic plan,
yes,
there are
five of them.
There are five goals for our strategic plan, and they range. We, as a district, have pretty much laid out what we're going to be working on for the next 5 years. And those include, you know, of course, increasing academic achievement. That's a part of why what we do is probably the main thing that people go to school for. But also there's another priority, which is around the whole child. And that is a lot of my work, creating an environment where students feel supported, that is still safe, that there is a feeling of accountability, but we have supports in place for all members of our community. There's also an emphasis on diversifying so that we can have those conversations and have representatives from all walks of our community in our schools as teachers. So a priority for us is also diversifying our teaching and leadership populations to be more reflective of our student populations. We're also increasing parent and community engagement. That's one of our priorities, is how are we engaging with parents so that we can have those conversations that are sometimes difficult to have in a manner that builds trust and doesn't degrade that. So that's a huge priority. And then, of course, as a public school, we have to be fiscally responsible. We want to make sure that our operating costs and that the taxpayers' investment in our schools are rendering the types of results that they can be proud of in Durham Public Schools.
Fatima, you have had conversations with, you've spoken before the school board, you talked to the administrators at the Durham School of the Arts. What were those conversations like, and are you satisfied with those conversations? What were they telling you about the situation?
That's a hard question.
I wasn't as hopeful when I finished with some conversations with leaders, some of them actually not wanting to admit that this could be a racial problem.
It's not racism.
And so when that is said, and not so many words, that this is not a race problem, then I begin to be very weary that we can do the work to dismantle racism and our part in the school-to-prison pipeline if we do not recognize that it is a race problem. So I think in some ways it's been disappointing and heartbreaking. And in other ways, I have had discussions with Dr. Maddox and Dr. Mbenga, and those have been hopeful, and Dr. Bullock, and those have been more hopeful. But I do want to say, even in the hopefulness, I have found a degree of despair and recognizing that this is a huge problem, that you can still be a great school in a great district, but have systemic racism running rampant.
From imprisonment.
We begin today in Brooklyn, New York, where as many as 1,600 inmates held in a federal detention facility have been without heat, light, telephone access, and access to attorneys over the past week, even as freezing temperatures swept across the Northeast.
If you do not have heat in your cell, knock on those windows! If you are hungry, you want hot food, knock on those windows!
That's the sound of inmates inside Metropolitan Detention Center banging on the facility's windows in response to protesters asking about the conditions. Family members communicated with incarcerated loved ones from the sidewalk, yelling through megaphones.
Desmond! I hear you! Are you good? Are you good? Do you have heat?
Calls for a federal response grew louder over the weekend as visits from lawmakers drew increased attention to those being held at MDC. On Sunday, demonstrators stormed the facility but were driven back by officials who pepper sprayed them. But the pressure on the federal government to address conditions worked, and last night, power returned to the facility. Stephen Nesson is a reporter here at WNYC who's been covering the story from Brooklyn, and we're also joined by Nicholas Turner, president and director of the Vera Institute of Justice, which has looked closely at the issue of extreme temperatures and unsafe conditions in federally run prisons across the country. Nick, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
We're going to start with you, Stephen. Stephen, things got pretty intense yesterday at the Metropolitan Detention Center. You brought us that amazing tape. Give us a rundown of what you saw.
Right. So you heard that banging on the windows. That's when you arrive at the facility, that's kind of the first thing you hear. It's just the steady, like, drumbeat of hands on glass. And pretty much starting last Thursday, I believe, it really was brought to the public's attention that this facility hasn't had power for nearly a week. Heat was out. We had this frigid temperatures. I think the families of people who are in there were aware of the problem, but I think the general public became more aware of it last week. And elected officials rushed down there and protests began to grow. And you can actually access sort of the outside quite easily. You just go down a driveway. And so family members, protesters have been putting up signs with, you know, their family members' names on it. We love you. We're watching you. This is not right. And the protests have been gathering. And then Sunday is when you heard the tape that I got. A lot of elected officials were showing up throughout the day. Sunday was actually the first day lawyers were allowed to go in to see their clients. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you mentioned, but these are pre-trial detainees for the most part. Some of them have been sentenced, but most of them are still awaiting trial.
They've just been charged with a crime but have not been found guilty of anything. That's most of the population inside.
Right. So lawyers needed to go see their clients because they have cases coming up.
What are the lawyers and also the elected officials who have been able to get inside, what have they said about the conditions over the last several days?
Well, right. Sunday night, power finally got restored. But before that, inmates were actually in it was lockdown situation for the most part. So people weren't allowed to leave their cells. Huh. They were sitting in the dark because there was no electricity. And the elected officials were there all weekend touring different floors, and they were reporting that some floors actually had heat and it was pretty strong, but others absolutely had almost no heat and inmates were freezing. The city of New York actually sent, you know, a package of like 600 blankets and hand warmers, generators. And the elected officials say they didn't see any of those blankets anywhere. I mean, there are 1,600 people in this facility, and they sent 600 blankets. So, you know, it's possible they missed it. But they said the conditions were pretty dire. And with the power out, that meant they didn't have access to the computer system. And so there were reports that many people didn't have access to their necessary medicine that they needed. Some people were getting their meds, but others were not. So that was, you know, one of the big concerns.
And based on your most recent reporting, is everything back up? Hot water, heat, electricity, or is that still not clear if it's consistent throughout the facility?
The heat, I believe, is not clear. Electricity is reportedly restored.
Nick, I want to turn to you. The MDC is a facility run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which operates more than 70 facilities throughout the country. How do Bureau of Prisons facilities generally compare to other jails and other prisons throughout the country?
Well, it's actually hard to know. I mean, I think the first thing that I want to start out by saying is that when you think about prisons and jails in this country and the fact that we have 2.2 million people locked up in probably around 3,000 jails in the country and around 1,500 prisons. So I'm not just talking federal. I'm talking state and local. This is sort of the crucible of two fundamentally powerful forces. One is that there is no greater government deprivation of liberty that exists than imprisoning people and then the government assuming their care. So that's one thing that happens in all of those facilities. And then the second thing is that they are absolutely non-transparent. Huh. And let's just use this as an example. It took a week with the heat off during a polar vortex in a federal jail 2 miles from Brooklyn Heights, just across the river from downtown Manhattan, with people banging on the walls and windows and federal defenders unable to see their clients, to bring this to attention in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
That is indicative of, I think, a far bigger problem that we have in jails and prisons all around the country, except the problem is that we don't really know because they are so non-transparent. It's not as if you get to walk in and observe the facilities and the conditions and be able to talk to people. These folks are under the complete control of government. And so when government officials dissemble and say everything's fine, you know, we're dealing with a power outage, but it's, you know, everything's okay. How do you actually check and confirm that?
Right. What have, though, in the past, any complaints either from attorneys who have been able to get in or from inmates themselves, what have they said about this facility even before this past week?
Again, it's hard to draw sort of big conclusions, but there was recently a trial in Brooklyn where a corrections officer had been charged with multiple counts of sexually assaulting women who were locked in that facility. So I think we're talking about a complex of conditions that far exceed lack of heat or lack of light, but actually very dangerous conditions where people's where people's physical safety is threatened.
Wow.
So can I ask you, Nick, real quick, is that rare then that elected officials would get to tour the facility? I mean, they were there on Saturday and Sunday.
Yes, I think generally it's rare for two reasons. One is that I would say that for elected officials, there's a general incuriosity about what happens to the poor and mostly people of color who are locked up in this country. I would say that that is not just an incuriosity that exists with elected officials, but with the public at large. Mm-hmm. But also, while public officials can go into jails and prisons, those visits are generally controlled. They're choreographed. And so you don't get a chance to see everything. My guess is that this federal facility is probably in better condition and is probably better resourced than lots of jails and prisons around the country and is probably more subject to scrutiny than we would see in places that are farther away from media, that are farther away from a really active, progressive government.
You said that there's a blind spot among elected officials and the public at large that we don't think about this incarcerated population. Is it possible that the situation with the MDC over the last several days is going to lead to a broader conversation about how we treat the detained population in America and not just Bureau of Prison facilities, but county jails and state prisons and privately run facilities? Is that possible? Are we going to now have that conversation?
Look, I would like to hope so. I would like that Congress would hold hearings on this. I would like to see that this sort of maelstrom of attention actually does generate the kind of what I would describe as sort of transformational inquiries that really seek to figure out, well, how can we provide better oversight? But there's nothing new about this. Last year, there were in a disturbance in a South Carolina prison, there were 7 people murdered and over 20 injured. There have been suits against Texas prisons because they don't have air conditioning. This is Texas.
Wow.
There was a 2013 hunger strike by people who were locked up in California prisons who were striking not only against solitary confinement conditions, but also access to health, to cleanly facilities, to decent food that didn't make people sick. So this is not a new chapter. That we have been living in this environment for a long time, and so I'm a bit skeptical that it will actually result in change. But I'm also extraordinarily grateful that a lot of elected officials have turned out and that the media has turned out, and that I'm sitting here talking with you today about this because the light has to be shined on it.
There are national detention standards for the imprisoned populations of this country. I mean, are there any teeth to those standards? I mean, will there be any consequences for officials at this facility?
I don't know whether there'll be any consequences. I think I would say that the standards are difficult to enforce. I think that the standards exist in a broader paradigm that we have around criminal justice, which is that prisons and jails, I think the public agrees, and I would say that for decades, electeds and government officials agree, people have been completely satisfied with these places being places of deprivation and mistreatment and brutality and lack of respect for human rights. And so in that case, if that's the complex in which the standards exist, then then I think what we really need to be doing is fundamentally reimagining what these places are supposed to achieve and how you treat people who are in them as human. And we don't do a good job with that.
Just to look forward, Congressman Gerald Nadler, who's chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has said he will hold oversight hearings with the Bureau of Prisons. And I also was reading reports that a judge in the Southern District of New York will be having a meeting tomorrow to discuss with federal prison officials what she called disturbing living conditions in this prison. So there is some action happening. We'll keep an eye out for that.
We certainly will. Stephen Nesson is a reporter with WNYC. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
And Nick Turner is the president and director of the Vera Institute of Justice. Stephen and Nick, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And earlier today, the Department of Justice issued a statement on the conditions at MDC Brooklyn. They said they will work with the Bureau of Prisons to, quote, examine what happened and ensure that the facility has power, heat, and backup systems in place to prevent the problem from reoccurring.
The state where I was born carried me back to
Nearly a week after revelations about Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's past with blackface first emerged, questions continue about who will lead the state. Democrats have to decide what the future of their party will now look like.
In Richmond, Virginia, an unprecedented scandal engulfing the state's top 3 elected officials. It began last Friday when a racist photo from Democratic Governor Ralph Northam's 1984 medical school yearbook surfaced.
I am deeply sorry.
That evening, Northam apologized, but the next day he said he wasn't in the photo, though he said he had worn blackface in 1984, dressing as Michael Jackson for a dance contest.
Right now, I am simply asking for the opportunity to demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that the person I was is not the man I am today. I am asking for the opportunity to earn your forgiveness.
Party leaders at the state and national level have called for Northam to resign. As of today, he has not. Meanwhile, Northam's number 2, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, faces his own scandal. On Monday, Fairfax responded to an anonymous allegation of sexual assault, calling the accusation, quote, defamatory and false. On Wednesday, his accuser came forward, Vanessa Tyson, a California professor, providing details of the alleged assault in a statement through her attorney. Tyson says in 2004, Fairfax led her to his hotel room in Boston, where, quote, consensual kissing quickly turned to sexual assault. Fairfax issued a response admitting, quote, a consensual encounter with Tyson, but said he, quote, cannot agree with the description of events that I know is not true.
Have you spoken with Governor Northam?
Fairfax ignored questions from reporters today in Richmond. Also on Wednesday, Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring admitted to wearing blackface as a 19-year-old college student in 1980. Herring had previously called for Northam to resign. The admission came after a meeting with the state's legislative Black caucus. In his statement, Herring said, quote, this was a one-time occurrence and I take full responsibility for my conduct. All three men, once seen as Democratic rising stars, are so far refusing to step aside. If all three Democrats resign, House Speaker Kirk Cox, a Republican, will assume the role of governor.
Virginia's lieutenant governor is facing serious allegations of sexual misconduct dating back to 2002 at the Democratic National Convention. Justin Fairfax is the name of the lieutenant governor in Virginia, and the woman who is now going public with these accusations is Professor Vanessa Tyson. She is a professor in California, and her allegations against him are very specific, although Lieutenant Governor Fairfax denies these allegations vehemently. Now, before we get to his denial, I do want to read a statement or parts of a statement that she released just today. Now, here's what she says. What began as consensual kissing quickly turned into a sexual assault. The professor then went on to say that Fairfax allegedly forced her to perform oral sex on him in a hotel room while they were both attending the 2004 DNC in Boston. And then she also writes, to be very clear, I did not want to engage in oral sex with Mr. Fairfax, and I never gave any form of consent, quite the opposite. I consciously avoided Mr. Fairfax for the remainder of the convention, and I never spoke to him again. I did not speak about it for years, and like most survivors, suppressed those memories and emotions as a necessary means to continue my studies and to pursue my goal of building a successful career as an academic. Now, I want to show you what Lieutenant Governor Fairfax has to say about this. Again, he does deny the allegations.
The allegation is completely false, as was indicated in our statement. And if you read through the story, you'll see it's completely uncorroborated. And the fact that they would run a story on an uncorroborated allegation from now 15 years ago tells you exactly what this smear is all about. And so we have laid out our facts and our case. And in fact, this person a year ago came to the Washington Post with this very same allegation. They investigated it for several months, and then they made the decision not to publish the story because it was not credible, because it was uncorroborated. And what we know is that it's false and defamatory. And so this person then went into hiding and laid low in the weeds. And then the second that this issue popped up here in Virginia, and there's a lot of media attention, crops back up with the same false allegation.
So what Fairfax says there about the story being investigated by the Washington Post a year ago, over a year ago at this point, is true. The Washington Post did come forward and they said that they were approached about it and that they could not find any corroborating evidence, which is why they decided not to run it. Now, that doesn't mean that the allegations are untrue. And to be quite honest with you guys, when this story first broke earlier this week, I wanted to wait and give it a minute to breathe before we reported on it because I didn't want to regurgitate any, you know, potential smear tactics by the right. But these are serious allegations and they should be investigated because if they're true, he has no business serving as a lieutenant governor.
And her colleagues have corroborated her account and that the Post was also reached out to in 2004 about allegations surrounding him. It doesn't say, this article doesn't say by who, but I mean, that's pretty significant in terms of details to add to her credibility.
So in the Washington Post clarified that they did not run the story in 2017, not because it had red flags, but because there's only two people in the room and they just couldn't corroborate it almost by definition with anyone else. So the way that he stated it was not exactly right. And, you know, obviously he's angry because he thinks it's a false allegation. But him saying like she laid in the weeds and then popped back up, these are not good ways to characterize folks. And the fact that it's uncorroborated does not mean that it's not true. again, they were in his room. There was literally no one else there. How could you possibly corroborate it? That's why these cases are so difficult. Mm-hmm. And that applies to both sides. And I get it, he's trying to defend himself, but I did not like the framing of how he reacted there.
And she also wasn't laying in the weeds. She reached out, or the woman reached out prior to his inauguration in 2018. So she knew that she wanted to get this story out there, but they weren't able to publish it. I understand the Post's decision in that case. But to say that she was laying in the weeds until a scandal hit is just false.
Yeah, I totally agree with the way that you guys are criticizing his framing. Also, like, the tone in that statement made me uncomfortable. Like, the weird...
Smiling?
Yeah, the smiling made me uneasy, but I wasn't even going to comment on that, but I felt like I should. But either way, it's a super difficult situation because... what do you do, right? You want to take the allegation seriously. I do take the allegation seriously. But how do you investigate it? Because you have to get to the bottom of the truth. You can't have someone who might have done this, or if you can prove it, who did do this, serve in the position that he's serving.
Yeah, it's a nearly impossible situation. So, by the way, Dr. Vanessa Tyson is a Democrat. So there is no right-wing trick here in that sense. So let's just be clear about that, too. So, look, and there's one other possibility, which is that she clearly thought it was not consensual, and he thought that it was. Now, that's a smaller possibility because the way she describes it is very non-consensual. So it'd be hard to be have a different point of view on that. But nobody else is in the room. So if it's a false allegation. And I'm him, I'm enraged. And so I get that you're angry and you want to say, now I get smeared and there's no way I can defend myself because there's nobody else in the room. What am I supposed to do? And this stays with me the rest of my life. If you're her and this guy keeps saying you're laying in the weeds and you're coming forward and being brave, and then you get this, now you're being accused of being a liar, et cetera, and people won't believe you, that's horrible. And so I just don't know how to adjudicate these, so I'm stuck. I don't know if you guys have an answer for what to do in a situation like this. I don't know if there can be a further investigation that would reveal anything, but if there can be, then I would vote yes for that.
Yeah, of course, I agree with you on that.
The race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Liam Neeson, who has a new movie out. It's called Cold Pursuit. And just 24 hours ago, he made headlines for talking about an incident that happened decades earlier involving a very close friend of his who he says was assaulted. And Liam, first of all, I really appreciate your willingness to have this discussion. Sure. Because when it comes to race, it can be very uncomfortable. Sure. For people. And it just caught people off guard. Yeah. How you responded when you were asked about revenge, and you want to explain what you said?
Yeah, we were doing a press junket, and it was the topic of our film is revenge, and it's a dark comedy too, but its base is revenge. And the lady journalist was asking me, how do you tap into that? And I remembered an incident nearly 40 years ago where a very dear friend of mine was brutally raped. And I was out of the country, and when I came back, she told me about this. And she handled the situation herself and her rapist incredibly bravely, mm-hmm. I have to say that. But I had never felt this feeling before, which was a primal urge to lash out. I asked her, did you know the person? It was a man. No. His race? She said he was a black man. I thought, okay. And after that, there were some nights I went out deliberately into black areas in this city looking to be set upon so that I could unleash physical violence. And I did it for I'd say maybe 4 or 5 times. Until I caught myself on. And it really shocked me, this primal urge I had. It shocked me and it hurt me. I did seek help. I went to a priest. I heard my confession. I was reared a Catholic. I had 2 very, very good friends that I talked to. And believe it or not, power walking.
Power walking.
Yeah, 2 hours every day.
You can
to get rid of this. And I'm not racist. I
am not prejudiced.
This was nearly 40 years ago, but because I was brought up in, maybe I'm rabbiting on, Rob, so forgive me. No. I was brought up in the north of Ireland and brought up in the Troubles, the 60s, 70s, and early 80s.
And can you explain to people what that is?
The Troubles, the religion? Yeah, there was a war going on in the north of Ireland. And I had acquaintances who were involved in the Troubles. The bigotry. One Catholic would be killed. The next day, a Protestant would be killed. One Catholic pub would be bombed. A Protestant pub would be bombed. I grew up surrounded by that. But I was never part of it.
And
because
excuse me.
Sorry, go on.
But I appreciate your willingness to discuss it and to explain, to put it into context. And I know that you have heard from people or the reaction from people.
Sure.
And one response is the fact that when asking your friend, and I'm glad that she's okay.
Mm-hmm. She passed away, by the way.
Oh, I'm very sorry for your loss. Yeah. That you asked about color, that you didn't ask the person was tall or short, big or small.
I did, actually. I asked all those questions to you. I did. But I did ask about race, yeah.
Because what we heard and saw, it was only asking about color. You did ask about other aspects. Would you have had the same reaction if your friend had said it was a white man? Would you want her to go out
definitely.
And kill?
If she'd have said an Irish or a Scot or a Brit or a Lithuanian, I know I would have had the same effect. I was trying to show honor to my stand up for my dear friend in this terrible medieval fashion. And I'm a fairly intelligent guy, and that's why it kind of shocked me when I came down to earth after having these horrible feelings. Luckily, no violence occurred, ever. Thanks be to God.
Do you think you actually would have done it? Innocent black man who had nothing to do...
Yeah, I know. That was my feeling. That I did want to lash out, yes. Because my friend was brutally raped and I thought I was defending her honour. And I admit that. And it's a learning curve and it's...
So what is a teachable moment here? You said that you wanted to... Because it doesn't matter what you say. Some people are going to be outraged or others are going to say, well, at least he's admitting, he's being honest that this is a feeling that some people have that never really acknowledge it.
Yes, yeah, sure.
But what is the teachable? What are you hoping that people will learn from you making these statements?
To talk, to open up, to talk about these things, you know. We all pretend we're all kind of, you know, politically correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this country, it's the same in my own country too. You sometimes just scratch the surface and you discover this racism and bigotry. And it's there. I remember when we were shooting Schindler's List in Poland 26 years ago almost. And hearing remarks from drivers who were taking us to the set, thinking to myself, am I hearing this right? This guy is making anti-Jewish comments to me, who's playing Oscar Schindler in the back of the car. And it happened on several times. And sometimes driving to the set, we'd see swastika signs painted on walls, knowing we were been driven past this area to go to set.
What do we do? How do we have it goes beyond dialogue,
Robin,
and conversation.
You tell me what the teachable moment is. Please. I'm going to throw it back at you.
I think the teachable moment is that we have to own up to when we... The one point that I want to make out is that this wasn't discovered by somebody. You admitted this.
Yes.
This isn't a gotcha. This isn't like, oh...
Yes.
So I give you credit there. But also having to acknowledge that the hurt, even though it happened decades ago, the hurt of an innocent black man knowing that he could have been killed for something he did not do because of the color of his skin.
No. or people, and they could have killed me too. At the time, right. At the time,
but to get beyond it being a difficult conversation, and understanding that we do need to get to the root of it, to stop just yeah. talking about it, and not. I know that you're getting crucified in many ways before saying what you did.
Sure.
And you're not shying away. You're admitting that it was wrong. You've learned from that. But you have to also understand the pain of a black person
of
hearing what you said. What
of
you
course.
Said.
Absolutely. That. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And at the time, even though it was nearly 40 years ago, I didn't think about that. Mm. All those things surprised me. But it was this primal hatred, I guess, that really, really shocked me. When I eventually came down to earth and saw what I was doing, going out looking for a fight.
Not the way, that's never...
It's,
and that's what the basis of your movie, too, that just it goes on and on. And I wish we had time.
Violence breeds violence. Bigotry breeds bigotry.
There's no end when you do it like that. Liam Neeson, thank you. Thank you. I know it's not easy. I know. I wish we could settle it
See
all.
See the movie. It's a good movie, by the way. Haven't said all that.
It is dark. I will say that. It is dark. But we will have a lot more of the movie tomorrow. But thank you for coming here, as promised, to have this discussion with us. It means a lot.
Dark, right? Dark. Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 9, 2019, Negro History Month. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, observations. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many, many things to share. We'll try to be efficient. Number one, we will be here tomorrow. That would be Sunday, February 10. White man Brian Grogan returns to the cows. This is our 10-year anniversary, so he was last with us almost a little more than 7 years ago. He was with us. We talked about some of the history of white supremacy, white terrorism in the state of Virginia, how whites deliberately closed the schools in Prince Edward County for 5 years because they didn't want Negroes going to school with white children. Mr. Grogan has done a lot of research on that and Virginia history in general. I thought of him when all of the hubbub about racism has been talked about for the last week in the state of Virginia, where the Cows 10-year anniversary yoga retreat will be in a little less than 2 weeks. Mr. Grogan will be with us tomorrow. We'll talk about what's happened in the state of Virginia, which is a fascinating study in white supremacy in many ways. But that's tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here with a white man. If we are listeners in the state of Virginia, you should take advantage. Tune in. It's Sunday. You can do the church and then tune in for a little counter racism. Religion of white supremacy. Mr. Brian Grogan. Next, we will also be here on Tuesday. I said the Cows 10-year anniversary yoga retreat, less than 2 weeks away. It is plant-based food for the duration of the retreat. Dr. Ruby Lathan, she was in the documentary What the Health, where there are actually quite a few black people in that documentary, and some of them talking directly about racism.
Dr. Ruby Lathan, she is a nutritionist, and she talked pretty candidly about how she was having health problems. She changed her diet, plant-based diet, helped her dramatically improve her health. And she said tearfully that if she had known the information about food and giving up meat, dairy products, all of that, if she had known that information earlier, she thinks she could have helped her grandmother have a longer life and a better quality of life if she had known this information earlier. So that is why we're doing the plant-based, or just to further solidify why we are doing the plant-based diet and why that's so important. Dr. Lathan should be here. Might be worth your time and energy to view that documentary, What the Health? Racism, White Supremacy will be mentioned explicitly in a number of different ways in that film. And they'll talk a lot about why you should maybe eat more fruits, veggies, less of the cheese, meats, all of that, chicken, all of that. But that's Tuesday, Dr. Lathan, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Next, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program, The Cows, is constructive. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Got a new PayPal account about a week ago. So if you invested previously and just been using the old information, new account, the button is on the PayPal page. It's linked to Black Talk Radio Network and the description and all of that. It's been updated. So let me know if you have difficulties with the old account, but it's brand new. You can hit the blog and try out the new button. And it is set up for subscriptions. People had asked about that. Man, I wasted a lot of time talking with the PayPal people about that. But that is taken care of. So people, if you are interested in doing any sort of subscription, that is already set up so you can invest. Again, much obliged to all of the folks who have supported the Cows. A decade of counter-racist broadcasting. Listener supported. That is the only reason that we have remained on the air for 10 years. If you are not into PayPal, drop an email and we can get you a physical mailing address. Also, it is linked on my blog, my Amazon wish list under Gus T. Renegade. Much obliged to all the folks who have nabbed items for the past decade. It is immensely appreciated. I hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. This week, the compensatory call-in was, or one of the additional obstacles to getting the compensatory call-in complete was what they are calling Seattle's Snowpocalypse 2019. We do not normally get snow in these parts. It snowed last weekend, maybe 2 inches, which is a lot for here because it normally doesn't snow, and it actually stuck, which generally doesn't happen. And they're very ill-prepared for any sort of snow, anything more than like a half inch, and they are, you know, doomed until the temperature gets back to 40. So that caused a minor tizzy on Sunday, Monday, and it stayed cold, so most of that snow did not melt between Monday and Friday. It started snowing Friday, and it just didn't stop. It just snowed and snowed. And it accumulated in the city to about 6 inches, which is more snow than I've seen here in quite a number of years. It's been something to see. But the whites have been in their element. They have been out with toboggans and sleds and skis and snowboards and the Husky. I mean, they are having a blast out in the snow. The system of white supremacy undaunted. And in fact, I went to the grocery store. They do the same thing. I lived in Atlanta where they just go and buy all the milk and eggs. I've never in life been to the grocery store where there was not one single avocado. They bought every avocado in the store. I went to the market this morning and it was still snowing, quite a bit of accumulation. It was like 3 people in the store. I went this morning and a black male works there. I normally speak to him. He seems to have a high level of black self-respect. In fact, he spoke to me one time and he said, "Brother, always enjoy seeing you. As so many whites here, I just always appreciate seeing a black person." And I said, "Man, don't you ever call me brother again." No, I was courteous and pleasant, always try to speak to him when I see him. But I saw him today and he said, "Oh, these white people just came in and they bought everything. The line was wrapped around the store." He said, "I don't know if you're from here or not, but I mean, it's 5 inches of snow on the ground, maybe six. It's not like you can't walk. Most of these people, they live walking distance. They brag about, you know, biking and Uber and all the rest of it. They live, you know, probably within a 5-block radius, of the store, a lot of these people. So it's not like, you know, it's a big deal for them to get to the store, even if it snows. The store's open, you can go get what you need. They're just hoarding. They're just gorging. Just take, 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 take." And I thought, wow, that is an interesting way of looking at it, because it looks like they're, I just said, they got their skis and sleds and everything else. But that did happen. Next. "I'm so glad that the Cows Yoga Retreat is not this weekend, because they canceled dozens of flights out of Seattle. So it would have been a dicey proposition if I had been flying out at this time. Hopefully all the snow will be gone by then." But the Cows Yoga Retreat in Druryville, Virginia, the 21st through the 24th, the retreat is all sold out. Much obliged to all the folks who inquired and the folks who will be in attendance. We should be doing a live broadcast from the retreat so we can share a view or two. I guess if folks are disgruntled about the whole affair, they can share their disgust during the live program. But we should be in Virginia 2 weeks from now for the retreat. And again, even in the audio clip, they talked about Michelle King, the first black female superintendent, the LA school district. She just passed away at the age of 57, which is a disgrace, in my view, indictment of the system of racism, white supremacy, and how it totally destroys our health and well-being in this system. 57, disgrace. But plant-based eating, exercise, discussing counter-racism, and trying to mitigate some of the disastrous impacts of white supremacy. That's what the retreat is all about, replenishing and just trying to be helpful with what we are doing. Hopefully that's what will be happening at the yoga retreat, and sharing yoga. Yoga, you know, is a part of that, being able to exercise and connect with your body and feel good. I took class today, told people before the snow. It snowed on Friday. I got up and took my classes as it was beginning to accumulate, and still was able to get to class today, even with all of the snow. Felt great to get in and move around. That being said, moments in racism during yoga. I have shared so many over the past year plus, a little over a year now since I've been practicing. So, and this is so important, so important, because this is a lesson in racism, white supremacy, and yoga that I would not have learned. It is a concept that I've seen before in terms of racists being envious of black people, individuals with melanin. Seen that before, but in this context, experiencing it in this manner has been it has revealed a lot. So they have what they call a February challenge. They do this regularly. They just did this in October. And it's basically the same thing. It'll just be an arbitrary number of classes. This time they pick 20. So if you can take 20 classes before the end of the month, you get a substantial discount that can be used on the studio for classes or whatever you like. Okay, and it's not a competition. If everybody at the studio wanted to do this, everybody would get the discount if they took 20 classes. It's not a competition. So I normally take about 60 yoga classes per month. That's what I've been doing for about the last, 7-8 months throughout my time as a flood victim. So most of the time, this is not public information how many classes anybody takes. This is the one unique time during this challenge where you would be publicly charting your classes to see if you get the goal of the 20. So whites see this, and the racism, we've talked about this, whether it's not seeing a black person do well, seeing a black person who is expending their time and energy in something that is constructive and they're doing well and may even in some respect be doing better at this than the white people. And you can even put that in quotes because I don't even really know what that means in a yoga context. Just because you took more classes, what does that even mean? But anyway, where it could be perceived by some that, you know, he's quote unquote doing better than us at the yoga competition. Seeing how that upsets whites has been fascinating, and seeing it repeatedly. I've talked about the numerous incidents and comments that people have made saying that this is intimidating, that it's crazy, insane. The most recent incident of this, I go to class Friday morning, right before the snow, go to the 9 a.m. class. I go to put my X up on the board. So this is on the board. This is my 19th check. But technically, since we are counting, that was my 20th class. So that was my woohoo, getting my discount. And we still got another, I don't know, 20 days or 19 days left in the month for more classes. Whoopee. So I put my 19th X up on the board. And there's a white man, suspected race soldier. He comes up. He's going to mark his down. I don't know this guy. I don't talk to him. I'm sure I've seen him before, but we don't have any sort of rapport. So I give him the pen so that he can mark his classes. And he says, thank you. And he looks up at, I guess, my spot on the board. And he says, you make me sick. There's no punchline. There's no ad. There's no have a great day. That's so impressive. You take so many classes. Do you stay hydrated? Nothing, just you make me sick. And he goes and puts his X on the board. I cracked up laughing at this, absolutely cracked up. And of course, what shirt did I have on? Please respect me like I am a white person. I had the other one in the closet, could have switched it up. But I have my shirt on, of course, because I expect dogs to bark. I expect birds to chirp. I expect white people. You can fill in the rest of it after 10 years. But number one, I've said before, wearing that shirt sometimes is a reminder for me, Gus T, that I have to show up as Gus T, because whites for sure are going to show up as racist man, racist woman, racist child. I say consistently to not be surprised. I cannot be surprised about anything. I have been kicked in a yoga class before by a racist white woman. So there's no way I can be surprised about, and particularly with this board, I already knew this was going to happen again. In fact, I even stopped and thought, should I even participate in this? Because they're just going to be tacky and racist again when they see the number of classes. And again, this is not unusual. I do the exact same thing that I have done for the last 7 months. Take the exact same classes, exact same times that I've been doing, you know, for months now. I debated whether or not to do it, and I said, I'm going to do it because they're going to be racist. That'll give me more things to talk about on the program. It will further corroborate my point and just give me more opportunities for counter-racism. So fine, I'll sign up on the board. And they did exactly what I thought they would do. That's at least the second or third comment just in, what is today, the 9th? So just in 9 days, I had one person, they said, you are a yoga monster. Those metaphors that I talk about, it can't be that you are a yoga guru. I'm a certified yoga instructor. It can't be yoga master. It's yoga monster. What is Mr. Monsters and monstrosities, even in lotus pose, even on the yoga mat, you are still a monster, monstrosity, you are a nigra, and you make racist man, racist woman, racist child, you make them sick. And I took that literally. I cracked up laughing because I took it literally. It reminded me, it's been 10 years we've been on the program. There's a program, Whoopi Goldberg, a movie Whoopi Goldberg was in. It's about the civil rights movement, and that's a cowbell, I think, too. But it's about A Long Walk. I think that's what it's called, A Long Walk, Whoopi Goldberg. There's a scene in the movie where the white man, he finds out that his white wife has been ferrying Negras. They're boycotting the bus, and his wife has been given the Negra maid a ride. I think that's Whoopi Goldberg's character. And he was sick. He was going to take the day off work. And this made him so angry that his wife was given the maid a ride, this Negra, that he said it made his blood boil. He got up and went to work. That's what it reminded me of, that this nigra showing some expertise, some competence as a yogi impacted this racist on a visceral level, on a biological. That's what I'm taking him exactly at his word. You make me sick. You taking care of yourself, you trying to be healthy. It absolutely disgusts me to see that in you. That's the way that I took it. And that's the way that I think whites in general are impacted. When we make an effort to take care of ourselves, I think Emmy has said that she's another one. Taking great care of yourself, eating well so that you can be fit and healthy and really be healthy. Not just you look great, but I mean you are great and healthy because you're taking care of yourself. Where whites are furious, like you have the audacity, all the centuries of carefully orchestrated terrorism against you and your whole family, and you have the audacity to come through all that and you're still trying to take care of yourself. All of our hard work, I could vomit right now. I mean, that's the way that I took it. We had a listener, I wrote about this on my Facebook page. Sometimes I do try to share when there are racist incidents on the yoga in the yoga studio, just to make sure I don't forget before we get back on the air. So I wrote about this on my Facebook page. And a listener, astutely, she said, wait a minute now, Gus, you are a certified yoga instructor. Do you have to go to the studio? You could practice at home. You could practice. You could do your own sequences or watch videos or what have you. Do you have to subject yourself to this? Excellent question that I thought from this listener. And the reason I wrote out my explanation to her, but the reason, number one, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. If it's avoiding whites, you just wouldn't be able to go anywhere. So I do minimize contact, but I mean, you would just be stuck in your residence, and sometimes even then you can't escape from them. Two, in this context, as long as they keep their hands to themselves, and I was kicked, that was almost a year ago. So I've been pretty good over the past year with physical contact and getting enough space that so that I am not around whites and they're not able to strike me in class. As long as it's them saying something, I can deal with that no problem. As I said, it gives me an opportunity to practice counter-racism and to report, and frequently it just confirms what I already knew it meant to be white. But again, this has been very much appreciated because I didn't grasp how much that angers whites seeing black people who are trying to do well. But I do think it's constructive. There are things that you can do and learn at the studio that you couldn't do in a residence for some part, particularly if you have an inversion practice. Sometimes it can be helpful to get someone to spot you, which might be difficult if you live by yourself or don't have somebody else there. Sometimes they have equipment at the studio as well that you probably would not have at your residence. Mirrors can be helpful. There can be lots of advantages to practicing at the studio from time to time. But the hazard of racist is definitely there. I definitely thought it was a constructive question, and you have to be prepared mentally, physically, spiritually to deal with being in that environment with racists. They will not be present at the Cows Yoga Retreat, though. Last couple things, and then we will get to listeners. Let's see. There were many things that I could say about the audio segments. Maybe I'll sprinkle a few in as we proceed. I guess all I will say for the time being, I'll just get to the Liam Neeson bit that was at the end. This is the race soldier, white male, so-called entertainer who confessed to going out and hoping to be set upon, as he said, by niggers so that he'd have an excuse to kill a black person, kill a black male specifically. I guess I could pause here. I think I said it once already this week. Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Not officially in Gus T's top 10. As I said before, that's one criterion for how books end up in my top 10. Now, how often am I going to reference this book in explaining accurately what racism, white supremacy is and how it works? This week alone, I think I could reference Dr. Curry's book about four times with the audio clips, major things that were talked about just this week, at least four times. the freezing black males in the prisons. That wasn't just New York. I just picked that one, but I could have picked Chicago or lots of places where it was cold. Freeze those niggers. We don't care about black males. Stuff them in the prison. It doesn't get changed because we don't care. But the segment with Liam Neeson where he says he went out, he was upset, his friend, she got raped by a nigger male, and he went out and was hoping that a black guy would jump on him so that he could kill him. I thought that was important, revealing in so many ways. He used the word primal so many times. He used it more than three times. I looked it up. The word primal, adjective, essential, fundamental, relating to an early stage in evolutionary development, primeval. And the example they give using in a sentence, primal hunting societies. Psychology of relating to or denoting the needs, fears, or behavior that are postulated, especially in Freudian theory, to form the origins of emotional life. The definitions for primal reminded me a lot of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Something about this raping black male got to his core, his essential, his essence as a person, as a being on this planet, which provoked him from his primal essential core, which provoked him, kill nigger male, kill nigger male. That was the response emanating from the core of his being, kill black male, kill black male, kill black male. Fascinating. With that said, and I thought that was really interesting that they got a black female to interview him on this subject matter. Robin Roberts, victim. He admitted, he said he looked to be set upon, and I thought that was interesting because you hear so many of these instances, reminded me of Trayvon Martin's killer. You hear so many of these instances where what they say, I was fearful. I was afraid. The niggers are so large and powerful that, you know, Tamir Rice is just hulking. You know, they say he's 11, but he looks like he's about, you know, an NFL football player. That's what they say. You know, they got reports on this. It's exact same thing, but I thought that was important because Mr. Fuller has said many times when you go out and a white person, if they call you a name or something like that, sometimes the best thing to do is to escape, to flee as quickly as possible, because you never know when it's a Liam Neeson type situation where it could be that this person is trying to provoke you to respond and then, oh, they got a gun, or oh, they got a knife, or oh, they planned to kill somebody. You planned to go to the grocery store. Somebody is going to come out very different if you plan to go to the grocery store. I planned to provoke and kill a nigger. Maybe you have some martial arts training, self-defense, whatever it is, but probably you are not going to come out ahead in that situation if I came to this planning to kill you. I think he is probably not the only one. This probably happens quite a bit where white people go out and look to provoke and start confrontations with black people. That's why I say on a regular basis, whites are dangerous. Really keep that in mind. A lot of times, nothing needs to be said. When that white man said, "You make me sick," I didn't call him a cracker. I didn't shout at him. I didn't shake my fist at him. I didn't say a word. I turned, went back to the opposite side of the room. I made sure that we were not close at all during class. I laughed, and that was that. Frequently, nothing needs to be said. These folks are extremely dangerous, and frequently they'll just call reinforcements, other dangerous whites, to help them. Continuing, when he began to give examples, of course he says, "I'm not racist." It doesn't matter what the white person has done, right? You never get a white person to just say, "Oh yeah, I'm racist." It doesn't matter. "I dressed up." Yeah, I dressed up like Michael Jackson. I dressed up like Chaka Khan. I went out to kill five niggers. Yeah, but I'm not racist. That it doesn't matter what I've done. And other white people will come in. Yeah, that is true. That is true. And, you know, I myself dressed up like LL Cool J once or twice. But, you know, I voted for Obama, so I feel like that balances it out. In that segment with Mr. Neeson, he said that I'm not racist. And that if it had not been a nigger, if it had been a Scot or a Brit, and I said, stop right there. you're practicing racism, white supremacy. If Scots, Brits, all the rest of it, those are not racial classifications. It would have been if she had said, a white man raped me, I would have went out and the first cracker to step out of the door, bam, I'm going upset. That's what it would have been, not a Scot or a Brit, because there are black Brits. We've had some on the program. Such people exist. So that's not really being truthful, Mr. Neeson. You would have to give us a racial classification. You would have to tell us if, you know, she had said a white man raped me, I would have went out and I'd have been looking for white men and for days, and I would have had a primal response to go out and kill white men. That's not what he said. He didn't even say that about the Brits, that he would have had a primal response to go out and kill British men, presumably, or Scottish men, or whatever it is. Also, I thought Robin Roberts, victim of racism, white supremacy, but she said to Mr. Neeson, suspected race soldier, she said, you're being crucified. This here program is the one where we say no metaphors. That isn't a metaphor per se, because crucify is a verb, but it has such a strong religion of white supremacy connotation. White Jesus was crucified. It's so easy that you end up saying things and suggesting that whites are gods. I mean, that's what they're saying, religion of white supremacy, but we're consistently using language where they're being referred to as gods and Jesus. I would not say that he's being crucified. He's being maybe criticized at some level for his racist commentary, and rightly so criticized, but I mean, crucified, really? I could say a lot more about that segment and many of the other segments that aired, but I will stop there. I will say again that this program, we do not use metaphors. That segment on the Young Turks, whew, I have more time to talk about Virginia tomorrow, but the segment on the Young Turks where they continue to say that Justin Fairfax, they did not like him saying that his accuser was laying in the weeds. And I think all three of them came back. All of their commentators said, oh, yeah, sink everyone. I didn't like that. Him kept saying she's laying in the weeds. I didn't like that at all. That's not the way that you talk about people. Paying attention to metaphors and the ideas that they convey directly, indirectly, is very important. Somebody else does that on a regular basis. I had a big smile when I heard them spending so much time dissecting the language that this accused black male used in defending himself. If we could not use metaphors for this program, as stated, frequently the metaphors enforce racism, white supremacy. Robin Roberts, she said, of his film, she said, that movie is so dark. It's a dark movie, dark film. If we could not use metaphors, they frequently reinforce racism, white supremacy, and or racists employ them to deliberately deceive victims, myself included. Often we're still learning, and so we don't have logic to articulate our views completely. We'll use a metaphor or comparison to share our thoughts, and a lot of times that just adds to the confusion. If we could be direct, explicit to what we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, views, observations, that would be grand. Make sure that everyone has a chance to speak at least once after everyone has spoken once. If you have additional comments, questions, or suggestions, you can feel free to share. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments you would like to share, proceed. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele calling in live from Los Angeles, California, here in the Koreatown section of that part of the world. And I wanted to focus my contribution in this week's discussion on the Liam Neeson story. I think that it's it's very disturbing the efforts that racists are making to condition black people to explain away and to rationalize wanton and blatant acts of racism. I was pretty surprised to see that one of the prevailing reactions that I've seen from other black people, presumably, because this is mostly on the internet that I've seen this, so you don't know exactly who's writing this, but I'm looking at the profiles, and these seem to be real black people, genuine victims of racism, writing some of these responses that basically absolve Liam Neeson of any guilt associated with his behavior. And oftentimes, there will be this this expression of empathy, which is strange because some of the people that I see expressing this empathy, you don't see them extending the same amount of empathy to black victims of or to black people who try to explain any sort of character flaws or any sort of past transgressions. You don't see that. A reaction that I saw was, you know, I would hate, you know, all blank too. So they'll just insert any other group for to substitute for black people in Liam Neeson's explanation. And the fact that they're having high-level black people or highly visible black people participate in this demonstration of capitulation to racist aggression is something that is extremely disturbing. I don't think it's an accident that they had a black woman, somebody who I don't think is capable, especially a black woman who I don't think is capable of expressing any sort of critical attitude towards a white person to interview Liam Neeson. I thought it was completely inappropriate for her to use the word crucified to describe the reaction to this admission of racism on the part of Liam Neeson. And I will point out that Liam Neeson, you know, this report, this self-report, this admission of guilt from Liam Neeson is pretty much in line with characters that he's played throughout his career. I think that he has a series of movies called Taken, which are basically white propaganda that explores pretty ancient themes of white slavery. And it's probably, it's painted as a funny movie series at this point in time, but honestly, it's one of the most racist movie series that I've ever seen. And then on top of that, you know, there's this theme of absolving white actors of practicing racism. I think the most famous one that exists here in the United States prior to the Liam Neeson case was Marky Mark Wahlberg. He basically went to jail for a very short period of time for blinding a non-white person in a racist attack. And, you know, if you read subsequent articles that came up when he was trying to get, I believe, a restaurant license here in California, his prior conviction came up, and there was a huge campaign, a PR media blitz, that went on to absolve Marky Mark of this crime. And the victims did not want to participate. Also, you know, I saw a movie where with Marky Mark recently whereby it was called Ted. And he played opposite of Seth MacFarlane, who was playing a doll who was basically a stand-in for a black person. The whole movie was about how this person, Ted, is not documented as a person. And the entire movie was just nigger joke after nigger joke after nigger joke. And they even had some of the most cartoonish looking appearing victims of racism sprinkled throughout the movie in order to deliver some of these punchlines. And it was probably one of the most repulsive things that I've seen. I was at a person's house who was playing it, and they didn't even realize just how racist this movie was. And this person who was playing it was a victim of racism as well. So I'll go ahead and mute my line at this time. I just think it's really disgusting the amount of effort that has gone into making victims of racism feel that acts of racism and displays of racism are acceptable. And I think that we need to fight against this at every turn. Thank you so much.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. I think whites have done a really good job at conditioning, and that we had better not sound as though we do not want to forgive racists. They, for years, have done such a thorough job with that brain trashing that a lot of victims, that is, we have been conditioned. I think that's the way the broadcast generally ends. Our conditioning has been conditioned, and that is very high on the list. Dr. Welsing talked about that on one of her broadcasts here, in terms of getting to that point where we are not about forgiving, understanding what it means to be white. And yeah, just these folks are dedicated to practicing racism, white supremacy, and we need to be dedicated to solving this problem immediately. I also did want to make sure that I got in really quick before I nab other hands from the switchboard. I could have said many things about many of the reports. I also thought the same way that I thought that it was a methodical decision by racists to have a victim of racism, Robin Roberts, interview Liam Neeson. I thought that that was deliberate. I also thought it was deliberate, the segment about racism, white supremacy in Durham, North Carolina, the public schools. They had two victims on, a black female mother, Fatima Saleh, hope I'm saying her name correctly, and then they had Laverne Maddox Perry. She's the representative from the school district. She's the executive director for student support services, so she's not even like the principal or whatever. But they get her on as the representative of the school, this black female. And so then it can be you two. You all can argue it out about racism at the school, and then you can have this white man, Frank Stacio. I can be the referee. I'll arbitrate. You know, I'll ask mom a question. Oh, that's terrible. That's what they did to your son. Oh, they put him down in the dungeon. Can't believe that. And then, well, what do you got to say about that? And then you go back to the black crafted. They do. I think they do that sort of thing on a regular basis. And Dr. Cambon, he's lives in North Carolina, so he gets to hear North Carolina Public Radio much more regularly than I do. And he said about this station specifically, WUNC, that's where that came from, and Frank Stacio, that they do a lot of racist broadcasting just in the times that they talk about black people. He said it's very, it's almost like they have a formula. These are the ways that we like to present niggers. And this seemed to be a part of that formula. We'll have the niggers debate and argue with each other about racism, white supremacy in the school where they're white people are most to blame, and there's no white person here to answer any of the questions about why this is happening. We have a black female who's not even the principal. She is her title exactly, the executive director for student support services. Not that I'm degrading that position. I'm just saying that does not sound like this is the most powerful person at the Durham Public Schools. I could be in error. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guests. Greetings to all the callers and the listeners. This is Ngame in Nebraska. I wanted to touch on something that you just mentioned. Well, first, I noticed how during the Liam Neeson interview, toward the end of the interview, as he was leaving, the in-studio audience applauded as he left, and it seemed very sympathetic towards him, as if admitting that he committed racist acts without admitting he's a racist was good enough for him to get a pass. And something you just touched on, I noticed how the incidents, like the accusations against Justin Fairfax and Liam Neeson's admission of his racist acts, seem to incite more conflict between non-white people. And those conflicts seem to be highlighted by the media, like the Facebook event notification that you shared with the interview on Good Morning America. I noticed how they were highlighting tweets from non-white people with opposing reactions to his racist acts, from someone saying he needed to be condemned, his admissions weren't good enough, to someone else saying, oh, he needs forgiveness. And I just noticed that those highlights by the media seem to be very purposeful in inciting more conflicts between non-white people. I guess that's to be expected. And that's all I have to add. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Excellent point, sir. I thought the applause, and they applauded repeatedly. Like, normally you have a guest on and it would just be, oh, okay, thank you, Kanye, for, you know, coming to hang out with us, and always a hoot to hear from you. Good luck with your fashion. Kanye West, woo! That's normally what they do. I've watched a lot of television in my time on the plantation. It's not, oh, all right, well, thank you, Mr. Neeson. We just want to thank you for just being candid and right. He was so curt. Okay, okay, okay. And then they waited a few minutes, and then it was, well, thank you, Mr. Again, he came on, and you didn't have to do this. And well, all right. And then they clapped again, like, wow, for real? Like, that much for just admitting that you were going to go kill some niggers? Like, really? The applause, I thought, was really important, as well as the response. I think that's why Mr. Fuller, his concept of VGQ, Victims Guarantee Qualified, I think that's why that's so important, so that you have a code, so that we are not bickering with each other. Even if you say the victim, I don't agree with the stance that they've taken, I'm not going to get into an argument. You can take whatever position that you want, just like I can take whatever position that I want, and we don't have to have an argument about it. If we can have courteous dialogue, or maybe you can explain logically your position and I can explain my view, fine. But if it's going to do, you know, where we're name calling or we're not even having courteous exchange anymore, nah. That there are a lot of that happens in the system of racism by design. Others who dialed in with a hand up.
Hello.
Greetings. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Everyone's having the best season they can have. I guess to continue on Liam, whatever. When she asked what could be done, he threw the question back on her. That is a tactic that they use a lot. And I think I said this before a couple of years ago when I was in a forum with white people. They asked, what can we do? I said, pay me. That is the only answer. And the rate, I believe, should be $50 million. Where did I get this from? On one of the shows, you talked about an academic asking white people how much, white students, how much they would give us to be white. I think he said it was about $40 million. I don't know what the number was. So let's say 40. 10 to 40. I'll say 40. And then because I am actually black, classified as black, $10 million on top of that. That should be the beginning. If the check does not clear, please stop asking me questions because it is your problem. You want me to consult you, the fee is $50 million. Point blank, case closed, let's move on. The article, the story about the young principal who passed away, they couldn't let her rest in peace. In the beginning, oh, she's wonderful, she's a deal maker. Then as the story went on, well, she was really shy and she couldn't make up her mind. Was she a deal maker or was she not a deal maker? You know, if you don't want to see your life, then just don't write the story. Another black person died, keep it moving, because you don't care. But please don't pretend that you do. I was reading online the singer known as Rihanna. I guess there was a stalker. The stalker is not going to do jail time. So I was looking online to see what the stalker looks like. Not that I would find him. But there was no picture. So I was thinking, oh, this could happen to her again. Whoever this person is, she may not know what they look like. I hope she does. But But no one knows what this person looks like. So if they happen to see Rihanna or fans, she has a lot of fans, they can't even go. Just the crazy man that tried to get Rihanna. So she, whereas someone tried to steal Taylor Swift, picture came up right away. The person's in jail. This, that, and the other. No, not, we can't harm her. Not that either one should be harmed, but of course, one is protected and one is not. All these sexual allegations, there was more against someone else. You know, people don't want to be virgins or whatever. You know, say it again. Just wait till you get married. At least you have some kind of idea that this person, at least one time, who wants to have that type of relationship with you, they married you. Save yourself, save your life. And, of course, Miss Roberts is in a homosexual relationship with a white person. Cannot forget that. Thank you.
I did forget that. I did forget that. That is so important. My goodness. Thank you for the reminder. Other victims, that would have been correct too. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings in Chicago. We have your type of weather here in Seattle.
Yes, indeed. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Just two things. You mentioned, Gus, about your experience and the white guy or, you know, the terrorist who said that you made him sick because you're taking all the yoga classes and you're practicing yoga at an optimal level. And then you started to explain about how white people hate it when there are black people who are taking care of themselves as far as health. And it kind of reminds me of how they age and how we age as black people, in particular non-white people, where we age better than white people. You look at some white people and I say most white people, and, you know, they look 20 years older than what they are, but you take a black person who really takes care of themselves and they look a lot younger than what they are. So that is probably what they hate about us, and probably why you made that white person sick, because you're taking care of yourself and you probably look younger than what you expect. In regards to the Liam Neeson interview, I kind of contrast that with, in particular, because the interviewer, like you mentioned, was Robin Roberts' victim. But I kind of contrast that with the interview she did with May Parker a couple of years ago, and how the tone of it was very different. She was pressing May Parker on apologizing and accepting what he did, even though, and also May Parker victim, but also in a tragic relationship. But, you know, he was acquitted of, you know, his so-called crime. But she never pressed Liam Neeson to apologize, and there was not kind of like a, you know, a tensions, you know, interview of, you know, accept what you did or anything like that. So I kind of took note of that as well. The tone of it was different. You know, you can treat a black man any way you want to, basically treat him badly, but you know, you better not press this white man about apologizing for, you know, wanting to kill, you know, kill a black man or anything like that. So that's all I have up in my life.
Now, that is an interesting case study to view those two, because Mr. Parker is innocent, adjudicated court of law, innocent. White people said so. Mr. Neeson is guilty by his own account of wanting to go out and kill a black person. Yeah, that would be interesting to compare and contrast those two interviews. Nate, his name keeps coming up. People keep bringing. I still have not seen
The Birth of a Nation, Nate Parker's film. Still have not seen it, but he went to the Nat Turner Trail. That's where the Cal's Yoga Retreat will be in less than 2 weeks. Mr. Parker went there and talked to Mr. Khalifa and filmed on the property and everything. I think he took the Nat Turner Trail also. Others who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings. This is from Hockey City. The weather. So they have a newscast, and they'll do a forecasting of the weather. And the way that it's been explained to me, or the way that I've read, I've understood what I've read and what I've heard, is that the way that people are able to predict the weather is that the weather happens further west than wherever you are usually. And then it comes to you to some extent. And then, you know, wind goes in different directions. So there's some variation. So, but anyway, they can see a storm or whatever it is, hot, a heat front or a cold front, however they call those. So they can see it from a distance away, and then that's how you know, okay, it's going to rain today, it's not going to rain tomorrow, it's going to snow the next day, you know, and so on and so on. And, you know, they can predict 10 days or so. Well, so I know that currently, yeah, you can predict the weather that way for the most part, you can predict the weather that way, but because white people are here, and they have to survive if they're going to be here. You know, that's how they're here. It's because they're planning to survive, or they're surviving. If they're going to survive, they're going to need it to be cold. And in order to make sure that it's cold, because you make sure that you survive, so then you make sure that its conditions are so that you can survive. So they make sure that it's cold because they need that to survive. So in order to make sure that it's cold, they block the sun. So I figured, I can predict, well, they send their planes out every day, but I can still predict. If I see that it's going to rain on Tuesday, then they're going to take their planes out on Sunday and Monday. You know, so that's one thing. And then so far west, where you're on the coast, like I don't remember actually seeing planes flying over California, the part of California I was in, so I don't know, but I think it might not be so easy to manipulate the weather so close to the coast. I'm not sure. But anyway, the other thing is a number of years ago, I had done an inventory of the images in my mind. I closed my eyes, and I played the images that I allowed to play. And it was a whole bunch of white creatures. It was a whole bunch of white stuff. White creatures, people, cartoons. And I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I don't want all those images in my head. I can't get it out. So, of course, they have all the images on the television, on all the billboards, on all the things in your house, the foods, the clothing, the diapers, on the telephones, everything that there is, they have their images on it. And it's bothering me. But we need to end white supremacy. We need to do it soon. We need to stop them from terraforming the earth. We need them to stop white supremacy. They need to leave America, leave everywhere else that they've come. So we need to do it soon. Thank you.
Much obliged, M. Hondisi. I know Red Nevada and some of the other folks who participated have talked about the impact of those images of whites dominating everything, it seems, including a lot of our mental space. And I know some victims, they have resorted to things like if it's food items. Either some victims I've said that, hey, that's for them, that is a signal that that's a food item that they're not going to purchase if it's got lots of images of white people on the packaging. Others have said that they will just take those images off or cover them up or cut that part of the package out. Dr. Welsing, she talked on a regular basis about minimizing television for that very reason, so that we can reduce the numbers of those images. But I mean, it's just ubiquitous in the system of white supremacy. I know folks have talked about the billboards and just it can be oppressive having all of those white images and creatures and caricatures taken up and being compared to Jesus. You know, Liam Neeson, he got his film out. I even thought at some level, this could all just be what they call a publicity stunt for his new film. Like, you can just come out and, oh yeah, a few years ago, I wanted to kill a few niggers. And what was the last thing he said? The movie's pretty good. It's a dark movie, but it's pretty good. And this is somewhat related to the film. So go out and check out the film, and you can think about killing niggers after and while you're watching the film, too. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Have you heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. Definitely, I agree with reducing the images. It's like all the images, there's a sector cycle, which I know since I've been in Las Vegas, there's a proliferation of what is supposed to be the standard of beauty, of course, mainly, all white women. So I definitely just try to stay out of those spaces where I see all that type of thing, and then not just white women, but then also, of course, all white males. So I don't know if that's helpful for me, if, you know, maybe that information is helpful for anyone else, and, of course, not watching as much television, if, you know, watching any, no television at all. The thing that I wanted to say about the clips, the first thing about the governor-elect, Justin Fairfax. I was looking up that story as the clip was playing, and
it
is a black female. Sorry, Lieutenant Governor. I was looking up the story as the clip was playing, and the accuser is a black female, and just trying to get more information about that. And it seems like, you know, there's, you know, only them two, I guess, were in the room or whatever. And like they said, you know, that started out consensual, but then I guess only in her mind, possibly, did she feel like this was not right. Because in the reports that I had read, and you can just Google, you know, Google the whole situation and her name will come up and even like her picture. And it didn't really seem like there was a, like, I don't know if there was any verbal indication that there was something wrong with what was happening. And it really just makes me think about people who have children, especially black boys, making sure that there is some kind of talk about these types of things happening, and even not just black boys, black males in general, even older ones. I don't know if, you know, maybe there needs to be some type of going back into your, you know, remembering or history or whatever, and, you know, making sure if this was not something, hopefully, you know, this is not an instance that can keep coming up. It, hopefully everyone's, you know, Area 8 encounters were, you know, on, I guess, consensual or whatever. But it just seems like that whole story is kind of odd, to say the least. Especially if there was nothing to, I guess, to him, I guess, you know, both sides, you know, to him to indicate there was nothing wrong with, you know, the sexual act that was performed, and then with her, you know, if it was just in her head, then how would anybody else know? Then also maybe even, you know, teaching black females to not, and not saying that this Vanessa, the doctor, Professor Vanessa, did anything wrong, we don't know, but also teaching black females that this rape or even accusations is not a way of, should not be used as a way of revenge or anything like that. That's the main thing that I'm really keep coming back to when it comes to black victims of racism. The other thing I was reading in the Las Vegas Review Journal, there was a story about how they were cutting funding to schools it says they were supposed to get, I'm sorry, that says that the title of the article, it was published about 5 days ago, says 55 Clark County schools to lose millions in federal funding under new formula. And just the summarized version of the article is that if the schools now, if they don't have at least a 60% attendance rate of students who are qualified for reduced lunch or free lunch, then their funding will be reduced dramatically. And that could mean, I was trying to break down, and this is referring to Title I funding. So just looking up basically what Title I is used for, there'll be like AP classes. They also reference like English, helping students to learn English. There was also teachers, cutting back on teacher funding, things like that. And it says that before, if you at least had a 50% population of students who would qualify for free or reduced lunches, then they would get, you know, the funding. So I definitely just thought that that was interesting. But another thing that I'm constantly seeing, and I don't know if this happens with other newspapers, you know, around the country, but they really don't, especially when it comes to funding and to money, they really don't go into explicit detail. The article can be 2-3 pages long, and if it talks about funding, especially when it's in the control of suspected racist white supremacists, they don't break down everything. It does say that one sentence, it says, overall, the district received roughly $95 million in Title I funding for high-poverty schools this year, spending $64 million directly to 279 schools, including district-sponsored charter schools. District anticipates giving $67 million to schools in 2019 to 2020. But if it says it's going to receive about $95 million and it's only going to spend $64 million, that's a large difference. And I couldn't find, okay, well, what is this other millions going towards? It's, you know, if you're going to cut back funding on schools, we should have more information about why you want, where's the other amount going to. I think... And yeah, I guess that's all I'll share this week. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Racists are phenomenal at concealing information. Absolutely phenomenal. Much obliged for that report, Red. I guess I'll ask, just because I was curious with your commentary about the Lieutenant Governor Fairfax situation in Virginia. Did anything that you've seen about the allegations thus far, did anything suggest that this might have been, this allegation may have been reported as an act of vengeance?
I don't necessarily want to say an act of vengeance, but it just does not, I don't think that it seems correct to accuse someone for something if there was no indication prior to, or like during the act, that this was something that was not wanting to be done. I guess to be, you know, explicit, one of the articles, it said that basically her account of the event was they went to their, you know, some hotel room, or they were at the convention. They went to, I think it was a hotel room. They were kissing, and then she said that she couldn't move her neck, and then her head was guided down to his genital area. And then she was, I guess in her account, was forced to perform oral sex. She said that there were tears or crying and gagging. But then there was not I told him to stop, or I pushed away, or anything like that. And I guess, like, in my own experience, I know I've shared before of being, you know, victim of sexual assault, it's almost like, and I guess every victim is different, but you can kind of replay what happened, even if it was, you know, 20 years ago or whatever, you know exactly what happened. And it's kind of like, it's kind of odd where it's like some of these details are left out. So that's my main concern. If he had no indication that you did not want to do this, then how can we then come out later and say this was an act of sexual assault? Comment the line.
Much obliged, read in Nevada. And for listeners, if you've not investigated further, it is a victim, as Red said, a black female, Red stated, a black female victim who is making these allegations against Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, who is a black male in Virginia. Other folks, if you have a hand up, *61, if you have commentary, if we've not heard from you, proceed.
Manny Hurd?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. Gus, good evening, all the listeners and callers. I just have a really quick observation in the Liam Nelson. What's his name? William Nelson. During the interview, and I literally cracked up at my house when he said, I spoke to a priest to confess. And I'm like, wait, which priest? The priest that are raping the nuns? And sexually assaulting the kids? I don't know. That was just absurd to me. I just got a good shuffle off of that because that was supposed to make it all better. Confessing, wanting to kill a black man to the rapist and the pedophile. I almost mute my line. A wonderful evening.
Much obliged, the religion of white supremacy. And again, the man, it was so many times with the school incident. I also thought with the report about the Durham Public Schools, the use of the phrasing black and brown, if I heard correctly, she said it was almost exclusively black boys that were in the dungeon at the school. If that's the case, then we shouldn't be using the term black and brown. We should be saying explicit. Well, I mean, hey, if it's black males that were down there, then say that, you know, hey, that's who's being impacted most directly. But certainly that it's black students directly and then non-white people in general, but most specifically, most intensely terrorized by this, black students. And it seemed like she was saying black male students, which again, top 10, the man, not Dr. Tommy J. Curry. What he said in the text. I also thought that segment, it was important before I get to other folks, that they tricked the mom. She said she was going to write her report about how unsatisfactory the school system is in Durham. And they said, oh, whoa, whoa, wait a minute, slow, whoa, whoa. We'll make some changes. Give us some time. We'll get in a program and we'll make it right. And she says, okay, well, they're doing it. I will not write. And then her child comes back and says, oh, man, they just put a new coat a painting in the dungeon. That's the pro. And she said then she went ahead and wrote the letter. But that is, in my view, doesn't get any better than tacky. Like, uh-oh, just tell her that we, okay, and then throw, yeah, just put the paint, yeah, and then we'll go right back on. More niggers in the dungeon, and just go right back to the system of white supremacy. And again, Dr. Welsing, what did she say? Hey, when you mess around with sexual intercourse, the joke is on you. I've said consistently when we talk about asking questions, detailed plan. What are we going to do with our child's educational plan for the first decade of their existence? This should be a conversation before conception, and plan that out. Because if you don't, you already know, if you're in North Carolina, your child will be in the dungeon with a new coat of paint. Other folks that we have not heard from at all.
Can't be heard.
Greetings, caller in Florida. Again, our condolences for the loss of your father.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. What I noticed was about the interview with the actor, I think, what, Liam Nielsen or something like that. And I think some of those movies, it seemed to be aligned with the comments he made. He made like three or four movies. I think it's called Taken or something. And I noticed like a large amount of racism he was practicing. and deflection. He's talking about comments that were anti-Jewish and something that happened with Germany, I believe. But that doesn't have anything to do with the comments he made. And I agree with that. He was naming things like people like Irish or Brits. When she asked them, she used the term white. She didn't say if they were Irish people or anything. So they're conscious racism being practiced. I really think he went into that interview very well-versed in racism, as Dylan Roof puts it, because you can just tell when you listen to it that he knew that she didn't have a thorough understanding of racism. So he was able to utilize many racist tactics. And especially towards the end, as someone pointed out, used what's your solution method, or to ask to deflect what's a good problem solving or lesson learned to go with this, and had her doing the explaining. And she was really, in a way, saying she didn't really know, which is a logical, honest thing for a victim of racism to say. And see, but he already knew that. See, but he didn't really, I don't even think he really even gave an apology about the things he said. I just remember one statement he put out saying that, there needs to be dialogue or something, which really means he is pretty much keeping an agreement, or he really does think that's what he really means, basically. Like, he didn't really retract what he said, in my opinion. And I wanted to also comment on the Young Turks segment about the victim of racism in Virginia. And that's interesting that for the sake of timing, the allegations came out when the white governor is being, I guess, accused of practicing racism. But see, his documentation and his evidence there, and now he's coming out saying that he's put some kind of dark substance under his eyes, and he's basically making comments saying that he has done this before. He's had some prior experience putting dark substances on his face. So he's bringing up Michael Jackson, but the picture has, you know, a guy that's in a Klan robe on that picture. So no one thought to rectify that situation or fix that image in the yearbook. And that's more revealing, because somebody says, oh yeah, we'll just put this in the yearbook and we'll just show it, and that's just who we are. That's our culture. So nobody wants to say anything. And they try to make it seem like, well, the Democratic leaders, they're trying to get him to step down, and he just doesn't want to do it. So that's another pattern of a white person not just saying that they're racist, but they're not going to step down from their position of power. One last thing, he tried to say, well, the picture is racist, and it's just vile and it's disgusting. But see, he don't call himself a racist. So I expect that tactic to be used too. I don't know, it could be called inanimate racism or something, like where they apply, white people apply the adjective racist to either a shirt, a building, a picture, even a camera. You know, just trying to give examples, not really metaphors or anything, but they don't want to clarify themselves as a person, as a racist white person. So that's all I have to say, and thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, sir. They do that all the time. That's why, in my definition, because I feel like it happens, even they'll talk about institutional racism and they'll say, well, it's customs and it's patterns. You know, we got institutional racism. We just had customs where for a time, they just, niggers penises just fell off. You know, they were just customs, you know. They do this on a regular basis. And again, that's deliberate, where it's not identifying white people specifically. That's why my definition, where I say it's a global system of people who classify themselves as white. That way we get very specific that it's people that are doing these acts. That is so crucially important to point out, because I think that caused whites, I believe, they know that causes a lot of confusion with victims and just being able to come back, oh yeah, white people are doing these things deliberately. That's why these are very well-versed in racism. Dylan Roof, Liam Neeson, they are experts. This is not a coincidence at all. Let's see. Other folks, oh, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, could I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I want to comment on two things. One of them is about Liam Neeson, I guess his name. And the other is kind of unrelated to the news story. I start with Liam. I heard people, other victims, they were speaking out in defense of him. And I don't know, this is my personal opinion, even though I can understand that, you know, victims are victims, but, you know, it's just like the self-respect thing, and it's like people always ready to run to the assistance of white supremacy. And sometimes I think it's a little bit deeper than just confusion. I think it's about, in my opinion, I think it's about people watching out for their own careers and trying to keep powerful friends and stuff like that. You know, it's always a reason to excuse black genocide. You know, and what I mean black genocide, I'm talking about, even though he didn't murder anyone, but he believes in mistreatment and he believes in committing violence against black people. And my second thing I'd like to touch on, it might not be too popular to touch on it, because I never heard nobody even bring up this issue. And that's kind of one of the main reasons I wanted to say something, because I at least want to put it in people's minds and think about it. Just about how people try to capitalize on black genocide. Now, my confusion is somewhat mediocre, or I could be very high, because I'm a victim also. You see what I'm saying? But in my opinion, I'd like to touch on what I have observed with Miss Mallory. And kind of the timeline, like, you know, it's just like with the Women's March, you know, finding camaraderie with white women, even though white women sided with Trump and sided with Moore, who was running for Senator. I forgot Moore's first name, but he had a sex scandal also. But even though white women decided to, side with Donald Trump and side with Moore, and they still wanted to see camaraderie with her, and you know the number that did the. The large number of them that did. Now, I got to admit that they were very revolutionary during that that march also, because you had a lot of black women who spoke out against how white women were trying to manipulate them. So that I congratulate them on. But to me, the issue, like, we can't, like, side against our other half by seeking camaraderie with white men. We don't even have that choice. And the fact that many of them had that choice, it seemed like they hopped on it and take advantage of it. Now, when she was kicked off the plane, I kind of was suspicious about that because she didn't even say she was kicked off the plane because she was a female. Being mistreated because of a female, it was a male pilot who kicked her off the plane. So I never heard nobody even mention that she was kicked off because she was a female. All of a sudden, it was convenient to be about race at that time, even though it truly was, right? But, you know, it seems that people play games with it, just like the non-white people who are taking up for Liam. You know, I heard you use the word usual suspect when it comes to white supremacists, and that is the usual suspect. But it seems that it's a consistent pattern that I'm noticing. And I don't think people even want to recognize it. You know, we want to walk around blinders on. We want to act like it's not going down. But, you know, I don't see how people can't see it. And I think it's not our job to even bring that issue up, you know, for real, because I'm not a woman. I'm not a feminist or anything like that. So I can't speak to that. But I think it is important that you know, I wish they would anyway, be more serious about addressing that. And I don't even think, why try to do that? It don't make sense. But thank you for letting me share my opinion, Gus. And I also want to look into attending the retreat in Tennessee. I'm trying to see if I can stack up some money to do so. And hopefully I'll be able to attend. And thank you.
Well, the retreat, the white people, usual suspects, they made it impossible for us to have the retreat in Tennessee. So it got relocated to Virginia and it is sold out. So I've been telling people, because there were other people who wanted to attend, and we reached our max capacity to find a venue where that is black owned, major stipulation, that could host us doing this again if people have a constructive time and think it's worth the time and energy. And we will see about doing it again. Just find another venue, and hopefully you will get an opportunity when we do it again sometime if people think it's, you know, worthwhile. So stay tuned. But I did want to make sure that I understood, is the problem that you think needs to be addressed victims of racism, black people specifically, who are somehow, I guess, getting resources, talking about racism, white supremacy, when they're not really trying to solve the problem? Or is it the problem of specifically some of these black females, non-white females, who were, I guess, becoming friendly with these white women at the march? Is that the that you think shouldn't have been done? Which problem specifically was it that you wanted?
I don't mind anyone trying to get resources, because that wasn't even, that's not my intention. I didn't even bring up how they trying to get resources. Mm-hmm. My thing is that black males do not even have the choice aside like a male's move, where we got like real things, like we got our version of Me Too, and we got marches with white men, and we talking about how, you know, all this. We have to be serious about what we see. Everyone sees. I know everyone sees. And until that happens, why seek camaraderie with white women anyway? It don't make sense. Not to say that such things don't exist, right? That there are legitimate complaints about being domestic violence, being raped, et cetera, right? I have a relative of mine who was murdered by their husband, and that pained me a whole lot. You see what I'm saying? But it's not systemic. It's not like the courts do not prosecute. You know, I think a lot of times people protest. The reason we protest because there's no prosecution. But when people are being prosecuted when they commit domestic violence, why side with white women and protest against the masses of black men? You know, when they're being prosecuted for this, you know, it just, I don't know. To me. And then the fact that when it did go down, when a white male,
Yeah, and I'm making sure. When the white male kicked her off the plane, the issue of gender didn't even come up. Why didn't it not come up then? And that's all I like to say.
Right on. This is one of those. Yes, sir. Caller in Alabama. This is one, I would say again, VGQ, Victims Guaranteed Qualified, specifically with that last point about being removed from the plane and her mentioning or not mentioning gender or racism, white supremacy, or any other issue. Any victim of racism, that's their prerogative. They can do that at any time, and all I would have to say about it is he or she said what they said. That goes back to what I said before about us minimizing time and energy, complaining about how, or minimizing time and energy regarding how other victims of racism respond to racism. That is major, something that we need to be mindful of. With regards to victims of racism siding with whites, I think you said that's not a choice that we have. Clearly we do, because there are a number of victims of racism who do this on a regular basis. Now, you said that black males, that's not a choice that they have to pal up with white men.
Yes, sir. Hang on one second.
No, because you got 5 minutes and I was talking about white, about black males not having that same sort of opportunity to align with white males, black males not having that opportunity the way that black females presumably do with white females. I can say that Gus T. personally, I have been chastised, admonished by a number of black males for my views on Tim Wise. That's happened repeatedly down through the years. Jane Elliott, a number of whites that I have admonished where black males have certainly seemed like they were allied with Timothy Wise or any number of other white males. And I think Pamela Evans Harris seemed to suggest in her book that a number of black males were allying up with white women also. So victims obviously have that choice. And I think racists make that choice easily available. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. You don't want to try to work through the anti-blackness and difficulty of working through this problem with other black people. Just come out and hang out with racists. We're still going to practice racism, but we have resources that can be very helpful and, you know, lots of other things. We can use you for our various projects. That is a choice that they can make very attractive in the system of racism. And at least in my view, I don't think any victim of racism should be criticized if they do make that choice. I think I said that repeatedly going through Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, the worst book that I've ever read, where they do a whole lot of that, criticizing how victims allegedly respond to racism. So yeah, people can make that choice. It is frustrating, but that is going to, some of this just comes down to what does it mean to be in a system of racism. Some of these things, that's what I would expect to happen in a system of racism. It's easy to go that route, to just say, oh yeah, I can work with white people to get, it's easier to do. It's, if we were doing the yoga retreat with white people, it would have been way easier. Doing it with, trying to go that route is astronomically more difficult and designed to be so. So I think just understanding that, at least for me, I am not frustrated with any victim who is doing what they're doing. They are responding. If any frustrations that I have, white people are most to blame. And in terms of getting resources, I hear a lot of black people complain about black people not doing the correct thing with funding or what have you when they say they're about black liberation and they're not doing that. I hear that being raised. I know Dr. Umar would be number one to step on and say, oh yeah, that gets talked about a whole lot. Shout to Dr. Umar. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Should I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I'm going to be very brief. Earlier this year, we had fashion designer Prada have a little Sambo doll, a blackface doll. We had a fashion designer from Spain, Montclair,
also have a hoodie or a puffy jacket with the black face all over it. And we have now Gucci having a black face imprint on the hoodie or what you call a turtleneck, I guess. I'm hearing a lot of people talking about boycotting Gucci. And, I mean, I guess it never was an option to me because I can't afford it. But if you're going to boycott Gucci, Gucci is owned by Kering. Kering owns Gucci. You ever seen St. Laurent, Bottega Veneta, Balenciaga, Brioni, Alexander McQueen? I mean, there's a whole bunch of companies that we should be boycotting just off of the fact of, you know, we're in the system. But I hear a lot of people talking about boycotting one of them. Well, why not boycott the whole company? Now, at the same time, you think that Gucci, which have, they're rebelling good. They sell a product for a certain price based off of the fact that it's exclusive. Only exclusive people can have it. And you have all these black people wearing it now. Rappers got tattoos of Gucci all over their face. I think this was a PR, a very good PR stunt. Same thing that happened in the 90s with Cristal Liquor, a champagne brand that rappers would rap about. It's about $300-$400 a bottle. And they said, hey, we don't want these niggas drinking our liquor. And Jay-Z had this whole thing, oh, well, I'm not going to, you know, no longer rap about this liquor anymore. And it didn't affect Cristal one bit. It's still $300-$400 a bottle. It's still only sold to exclusive white people. So I think this was just a move by the brand to get some of these, get some of the black faces out of their clothes, so to speak. Now, the governor of Virginia, of course, everyone knows, he was trying to be like Michael Jackson and dress in blackface. There was another person from Virginia who also was caught in blackface, and he said he was in 1980, he was dressing up like Curtis Blow. Now, I mean, I was born in 77. Hip-hop is 45, I think, this year. So in 1980, I can't think there was another internationally known rapper other than Curtis Blow. So for them to have a hip-hop party where everyone would come in blackface, it makes no sense. I mean, there was no Run DMC yet. There was no LL yet. I mean, it was Curtis Blow and the Fabulous, the Fantastic Four, whatever, a few groups. So I don't believe that story. And then the Attorney General also was caught in blackface. Of course, in perfect timing, they have the young black gentleman being accused of rape to kind of, you know, cover for them. I mean, their actions. I think that's why that story is getting so much play. The last thing I was going to say, Liam Neeson, the Irish Catholic actor who grew up in Britain. He was born in 1952. He was a teenage boxing champion in the city he was in Britain. He claims his female friend was raped by a black man, so he went to a pub every day for weeks, just hoping that he would see any black bastard so he could beat him down with his club, his nigger knocker. And then they talk about toxic masculinity, and they don't mention Liam Neeson. I mean, this is toxic masculinity. Anyone would do it. I mean, with all the racism that's been happening to us all these years, imagine if we had that mindset. Any white person would do it. I mean, this is, in my opinion, just how they think. And just to keep him in perspective or in context, put him in context, it seems like every movie I ever seen him in, he plays a white man seeking vengeance for some act that's happened to another white person. So it sounds very, very much in line with the characters he plays, someone that's just out seeking the vengeance. It doesn't care who it is. So I believe it. And I hope that, you know, he never gets in another movie or makes another dollar, even though I doubt that's going to happen. Gus, I'll mute my line. Thank you, sir.
If Kevin Spacey can make a comeback, Liam Neeson, I expect things will be fine. He might even get the film where he gets to kill, you know, 3-4 niggers on top of it all. Incidentally, since you did mention Nigger Knocker, I emailed Dr. Martin Kevorkian, who is an admitted white supremacist, University of Texas, Austin. He's been on the program many times, but he has a doctorate in English. I've said consistently, in my view, the whites who study, they study language, but whites who that's like their profession is studying words. I think they are especially acute at discerning, sometimes even explaining, if you can get them to be honest for 2 seconds, explaining racism, white supremacy. So I asked him about just the term, that being a term that's used, nigger knocker. We had on the program Norm Stamper. He referred to his nightstick as his nigger knocker on the program, and that's in his book, Nigger Knocker. Also, there was a white male in Utah, or excuse me, he was in the Northwest, and he threatened a black male who was a city employee, no less, and he is reported to have called his baseball bat a nigger knocker. He was arrested and charged maybe with a hate crime. And so it's in wide use. In fact, there's another example online. An officer smacked him. Excuse me. I'll read the whole thing. An officer smacked him in the stomach with his baton, an implement that some LAPD officers openly referred to as a nigger knocker. This is in Bob Sipkin's Baby Insane and the Buddha, page 35, published in 1993. It's also, the word nigger knocker is also in the book Short Eyes. Joe got the nigger knocker wrapped around his hand real tight, dig? Anyway, so I asked Martin Kevorkian, what does that mean, having that as a term in existence and used widely? What does that reveal about the system of racism? So this is what he said. What you are saying about the racist words used to describe that police weapon involves that kind of recognition that language reflects and is part of a system of oppression. I had never heard that term before, but as you say, the key fact is that such a term exists and is used by those who practice violent racism. Some have said that the rise of the contemporary police state is itself directly tied to fears of racial uprising, that is, white fears of black violence. So it makes perfect sense that a weapon used by such a system could be casually and thus revealingly referred to in a way that reflects the intended purpose of that system, a purpose not directly revealed by more official terminology for such a weapon. I do even wonder if the term nightstick is itself tinged with a fear of darkness in more than one sense, that is, including a racial one. That's Dr. Kevorkian's thoughts on the term nigger knocker, and perhaps that being more revealing than it is intended. That is what the entire apparatus is about, knocking niggers. Any other folks we missed directly have commentary? Retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have commentary, sir?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Today, this afternoon, concluded another DCS session with a group of black males over the course of about 2 months. And it concluded with a visit to a restaurant dressed semi-formally with the organization's etiquette supervisor. She was present, as well as the boys' parents were there, and everything went pretty good. Also, I am continuing on with the project of putting another roof on my place of residence, which is something that is kind of standard in this part of the world, the state of Florida, where they, you know, have hurricanes and whatnot, that sort of thing. And, you know, after a while, the roof wears out and you have to get another one. This is my first replaced roof. The reason why I brought it up is because I think I mentioned it before, I hired a black company to do so. And what makes it kind of important is that you're not you're talking about more than one person. Actually, it's something about somewhere around 8 to 10 employees, and all of them are non-white black males. And so I have family members who have the experience of the roof to kind of like give me some counseling on what to look for, what to expect, what questions to ask. And so far, everything is going it's going pretty good. Because also the head guy of the company, he stays in contact with me. He said that he has the permit, and he gets started officially Monday. One last comment with the white male actor who made this confession. The clapping at the end for me personified the advent of him being a racist, and how that is thought of by white people. The clapping, in my understanding, was the answer to that. There was a white male actor by the name of John Wayne who was a member of the Birch Society, I believe it was called, which is a offshoot to the Ku Klux Klan. And I think that he maintained a very high status in Hollywood all of his life. So I don't expect that this white male actor would lose any fans. If he does, it won't be for him being a racist. I'll put it that way. It could be for some other thing that he's just not any good. I don't even know who he is, because I don't watch him anyway. But I don't think he would lose any fans due to this confession that he made. He seems to be quite confident in what he says, so it doesn't look like to me that he's worried about anything. And that's all I have to report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Did we miss any callers? He's white Jesus. He's been crucified. Liam Neeson. Any other folks that we missed completely? Soon we got everyone. Even if we didn't, we'll be here tomorrow, or with a white man, no less. Brian Grogan didn't get a whole lot in on Virginia, because we'll have the broadcast tomorrow to put all of that in context. The allegations against Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, black male, the allegations against Governor Coon Man North. Oh, I forgot. If you need comic relief, anybody out there, you're stressed. Racists have gotten on your nerves. If you need a good chuckle for 30 seconds, Ralph Northam, Coon Man, governor of Virginia, he did a press conference last week that was a little less than an hour. I played some of it last week. I talked about the Michael Jackson bit where he was talking about the blackface is really difficult to get off. If you continue watching that interview, about 40 minutes into it, after he's already said that he did dress in blackface at a talent show. He dressed up as Michael Jackson and he won the talent show and he moonwalked and all of this. A reporter says, so, okay, so you did all of this for this talent show, which you won. And he says, you did the moonwalk. He says, do you still moonwalk? Do you want to moonwalk for us now? And the governor, this is the current governor of Virginia, Governor Northam, Coon Man. He looks down at the floor. And that's why I say you have to see the video. He looks down at the ground and is this, and he begins to get this huge grin on his face like, man, it's enough room. You don't know why they call me the Coon Man. I have studied the Negro. Let me show you how I do. And he was with his wife. It was, he looked and he was about to do it. And his wife looked like, if you dance, you have got me up here and embarrassed me in front of my friends. Get back over here and you apologize for upsetting the Negroes. And he looked at his wife and he stopped. And he, I just want to say that Michael Jackson was great. And I apologize. And moving forward to the great state of Virginia. But for about 30 seconds, it looked like he was about to cut. And boy, I studied the Negro. I can show you the moment. Like, it is the funniest. The whole thing is hilarious. But that moment in particular, I didn't know that that existed until Monday. So I just got to. Oh.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. Just to butt in quick. His wife told him inappropriate circumstances. You can't forget that part. She said inappropriate circumstances. Then he said, well, my wife said inappropriate circumstances because she wasn't going to do it. You can't forget that part. She was like, inappropriate circumstances. Then he was like, yes, inappropriate circumstances. You know, he's like, my wife said inappropriate circumstances. Then he went on.
The white woman, I've said for a long time, is very intelligent, probably much more intelligent in terms of the logic of how racism, white supremacy operates. I think you're probably going to be more focused on the white woman for that. I would say that is a great illustration. And even just the look on her face, because you can see her in the frame when he's looking and he's got that grin in these circumstances. He's apologizing. I'm not a racist. I'm not going to resign. I'm sorry, Negros, if you're upset. Michael Jackson is great. Under these circumstances, it's, boy, I will show you. I studied the Negro. I can do it. What? Oh, yes, yes, yes. It is a somber day, and we're going to move forward. Thank you. My wife, Pam, that's her name, Pam. Pam is here, and we're going to get through this. I just want your time for forgiveness. Thank you, and God bless. Love you, Michael Jackson. Yes. Governor Coon Man. Governor Northam, same thing that I said last week. Do not resign. I want him to serve every day of his term. My only request would be that he and the Attorney General give us a talent show as Michael Jackson and Curtis Blow. And all of the Negros in the Commonwealth, if they want to call you Governor Coon Man, they should be allowed. As long as you serve your term out in office, if they want to call you Coon Man, they should be allowed. And give us a public talent show with the shoe polish, Michael Jackson, Curtis Blow, and let's see the moonwalk. That would be my proposal. No resignation necessary, no apology necessary, but let's see the dance since there's no footage. Let's see how well you studied the Negro. With that, we'll be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Mr. Brian Grogan, white man. He was on the program before. Some folks might remember. We talked about the history of white supremacy, racism in the great state of VA, where we will be for the Cal's Yoga Retreat in less than 2 weeks. But we'll be here tomorrow. And again, we'll also be here on Tuesday. Dr. Ruby Lathan, black female, vegan, talking about the importance of plant-based eating. With that, much obliged to all the folks who participated live. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Race soldiers have terrorized a lot of us. When we were not thinking correctly, not making great decisions, they have taken advantage. It would behoove us to preserve our brain computers so that we can come up with great new concepts, solutions to the problem, racists. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.